Blog Talk Radio.
Hello. Happy Sunday. Merry Christmas. This is Seeds of Change, and I'm your host, Danielle St. John. And we are joined in studio, and by studio, I mean from my kitchen table, with Mom today. She's here with us. And so I'm going to scoot over and let her say hello.
Merry Christmas.
Hello. I'm here to visit with my daughter and my wonderful son-in-law for a Christmas visit, and they made me carnitas. It's a uniquely Hispanic cultural food that's wonderful. It's one of my all-time favorites, and my kid made it for me today, and it blessed me.
I think it turned out pretty good.
It turned out wonderful.
You can't just be any geek off the street and make the best carnitas. So while we get logged in, people start getting into the chat, I'm going to, for the probably the last time of the year, play a Christmas song that we played the last couple weeks. So here we go. 3, 2, 1.
Have another jab this Christmas. Now the Omicron is here. You know the joke of COVID toad, but still you live in fear. Have another jab for Christmas when you're walking down the street. Don't say hello to friends you know in distance of 6 feet. I know the TV show dictates what you think. Fear has infected you, turning off your brain. Have another jab for Christmas. And in case you didn't hear, OMG, the TV screen controls you with fear.
It's a basic, truly primal instinct, and it too is contagious.
Is there too much panic?
Spraying Chinese-looking people on the subway.
Does he have the coronavirus or not? I don't know.
Our brains evolved to respond to dangers that we sense around us on our screen. Remember, stress, anxiety, and fear can be useful.
We go to the extreme sometimes to gain control.
We're going to survive this just fine, but there's going to be a slight panic.
I'm Fauci, the Christmas poo. Lock you down tonight. You have been in quarantine because you're not so bright.
Have another jab this Christmas, and if you were gonna ask, OMG, you're an NPC, cause you drive with a mask. Oh my golly, you're an NPC who drives with a mask.
Oh boy, our satanic power sure did the trick.
Okay, that's enough of that. Looks like John's here. Press one if you want to join the conversation. And I don't think Elizabeth's going to be making it today. I think she's got family obligations, which we love for her. Here's John. Hello. Merry Christmas.
Hi, yeah. Merry Christmas. I actually just got home from my family thing, so
perfect
good
timing. Yeah.
I didn't actually even know you were going to do the show today. I thought maybe because it's Christmas, there wouldn't be one.
We probably aren't going to do the whole 3 hours today. We're probably going to cut it short. But we wanted to stick with good news today. So Mom is here
All right.
in the studio with me. And so that's what we're going to start with is good news. And I put it out on Facebook that whoever wants to call in and give a Christmas message to whoever, then they can do that too. The call-in number, for those of you listening on the internet, is 319-527-6208. And if you press 1, you'll be led into the waiting room, so you can say what's on your mind. But with that, I'm going to turn it over to Mom for the good news report.
Merry Christmas, John, and Merry Christmas to all who are listening. It's been a really crazy week, as it has been, I think, since 2016. We haven't had even a small break from the insanity since Donald Trump was elected president. He really stirred things up just by being elected. And a conversation that we had over Christmas dinner, isn't that funny? We're kind of political animals around here, is about a Project Veritas video that was filmed right after the 2016 election. And it was an audio tape of an all-staff meeting with the employees of a company called Google, ABC. Is it ABC?
ABC Corp or something?
ABC Corporation, Google Corporation. And for, I'm sure, anyone listening to the show knows who Google is. Google is the only way you get your information. Every website, every internet site, every social media site is filtered through a Google website. And at this all-employee meeting, there were people crying. They were very sad that Donald Trump had been elected president. They had no idea how it could have possibly happened. How is that possible, they said. And as they processed their grief and distress that Donald Trump had won the election, they also decided, all of these powerful individuals running the most powerful corporation on the planet, decided that they were going to fix it. They decided that nothing like this would ever happen again. And at the time that that video was released, people scoffed at it, of course, and clowned about it and said, oh, please, these are just a bunch of people that were upset over the election. Well, it turns out they stuck to their word. And we're seeing finally the evidence of that coming out in something called the Twitter files. And I've been excited to watch the transparency over the last couple of weeks with the information pouring literally, just like it happened right before the 2016 election with the WikiLeaks dumps, which I believe had a big hand in Donald Trump's election. The information that's pouring out of Twitter, and keep in mind that if it was happening at Twitter, it is 100% likely that it was happening at the other social media sites, that their entire upper executive staff was either CIA or FBI agents, and monitoring and filtering and shadow banning the information that people were allowed to see, quote unquote, allowed free American citizens, worldwide citizens, what information they were allowed to see. And so I'm going to go a little bit over Twitter files 8 and 9, but there is some good news, which I usually will start here on the Pedogate front. This week, there was a prominent New York City artist, age 35, who was charged with trying to have sex with a boy 9. The activist, who identifies as a non-binary queer, also shared child sex porn and now faces life in prison. We can all celebrate that. Also, a gentleman that they called Child Porn Supremo, who was one of FBI's 10 most wanted fugitives and made €14 million fortune with films of underage girls being raped, and was arrested in Madrid after fleeing the U.S. So they got him. He's been at the top of the list of people that the international trafficking folks wanted to arrest, so we can celebrate that. Two Illinois men were also arrested for child porn, and so that's more good news. So I usually try to report on ones that I come across of child sex traffickers getting arrested because that makes me happy. And they should have a millstone tied around their neck. So I posted in our common chat about Twitter files 8 and 9. And I'm going to just go over it where I got this information about the Twitter files, Twitter and other government agencies. And again, it's Matt Taibbi that got the nod for this information. He says that after weeks of Twitter files reports detailing close coordination between the FBI and Twitter in moderating, so this is what he calls, what he says that they've been doing. They've been moderating social media content. The Bureau issued a statement. It said, the men and women of the FBI work every day to protect the American, this was their response to the Twitter files being released, to protect the American public. It is unfortunate that conspiracy theorists and others are feeding the American public misinformation with the sole purpose of attempting to discredit the agency. So, John, I'd like to know what you think about conspiracy theorists discrediting that.
I think the FBI discredited itself. I don't.
That's the right answer.
Because we already knew about was it somebody Page years ago regarding I don't remember the name, the first name.
Yeah.
But
in the last two presidential elections, okay, and there it's obvious. And you're absolutely correct. That was the correct answer. They have discredited themselves. No one did anything to the FBI.
There was a time before we had the FBI, and clearly it's not necessary, I don't think. I mean, we didn't have it before, and it was all right. So maybe we don't need it now.
No, exactly. We don't. And all they have done is cement their power over the last 56 to 100 years. I don't know how many years they've been in existence. We'll have to Google that. Oops, wait.
I'm not sure either.
It says...
It's probably, I think it's less than 100, but pretty close.
Right. Yes. So that Taibbi says it didn't refute the allegations. Instead, it decried conspiracy theorists publishing misinformation whose sole aim is to discredit the agency. It says they must think us as unambitious if our sole aim is to discredit the FBI. After all, a whole range of government agencies discredit themselves in the Twitter files. Why stop with one? So here we go. And this is with the backdrop of this last week. They released a bunch of the John F. Kennedy assassination files, and it's obvious that the CIA killed John F. Kennedy. So when someone gets in there that doesn't play ball, they take them out. They did it with JFK. They did it with Richard Nixon. And they worked the entire time Donald Trump was president to try to take him out as well. And actually ostensibly succeeded.
Yes, usually do. And just a fun fact that the Warren Commission, after the investigation of the JFK assassination, was the organization, the group that coined the term conspiracy theory.
Yeah.
And they still are using it to this. So it's actually pretty ironic that they're doing this, calling us conspiracy theorists again.
Still.
It's just not going to really cut it for very much longer, in this kind of a world with all of the stuff out there, all the information out there that's just right at the tip of our fingers.
It's true. And you notice we always call my segment the good news segment. And a lot of the information that I share is mind-blowing to me anyway, and I'm old school. I call it good news because I believe that we are on what I call the precipice. And It at this point, because there's so much information out there, it's going to drop and people are going to go, oh my gosh. And, I sort of made the comparison. Well, if they took over social media companies and they filtered American citizens' information, and they were so bold as to do the Russia hoax and the Ukraine hoax, and it is my supposition that they did, that COVID itself was the PSYOP, a mild virus released on the public, and we were told that it was going to kill millions of us in order to get people to take a vaccine, or it was really about an election. So, to continue, that's why I call it good news, though, because at some point, with all of these dams breaking, people are going to finally wake up, all of what we call sheeple. So, the files show the FBI as doorman to a vast program of social media surveillance and censorship encompassing agencies across the federal government. So this is where Matt Taibbi makes the case that, as we assumed, it wasn't just the FBI, it was all of them, all of the letter agencies, right? For the State Department, the Pentagon, and the CIA. The operation is far bigger than the reported 80 members of the Foreign Influence Task Force, FITF, which also facilitates requests from a wide variety of smaller actors, from local cops to media to state governments. Twitter had so much contact, listen to this part, with so many agencies that executives lost track. Is today the DOD and tomorrow the FBI? Again, back to those Slack channels where they're communicating intra-agency, intra-corporation at Twitter. They couldn't even remember who was coming at them to give them or request for them something to do with the information that was going to be on Twitter. Says, is it a weekly call or is it a monthly meeting? It was dizzying, according to Matt Taibbi. As chief end result was the thousands of official reports flowing to Twitter from all over through the FITF and the FBI's San Francisco field office. On June 29th, 2020, San Francisco FBI agent Elvis Chan, here's that name again, wrote to a pair of Twitter execs asking if he could invite an OGA. Okay. Anybody want to go with the pop quiz what an OGA is? Pop quiz. What's an OGA?
Original gangster.
Yes.
No, I don't know.
Is it original gangster? Yeah. What do you think, John? What's up?
I don't know. That's the only thing that came up for me. I don't know what they might
yes.
be.
Other governmental agent.
Okay.
So they're just an other. That sounds really innocuous, doesn't it?
Mm-hmm.
So she's requesting, I wanted to follow up to see if we could forward this invitation to an OGA, question mark. Specifically, the people from blanked out. Former employer was inquiring, hope all is well. So OGA, other government organization, can be a euphemism for CIA. As a matter of fact, it's a chuckle, it's a joke among the CIA agents that they don't call themselves CIA, they just call themselves OGAs.
Yeah, I think that's a reference to an individual.
Yep. Other,
yeah.
It says, can be a euphemism for CIA, according to multiple former intelligence officials and contractors. Chuckles one, they think it's mysterious, but it's just conspicuous. So it goes on to talk about the CIA's involvement after, you know, FBI opens up this portal into, or FA into the Twitter. And then they have what they have, these other government agencies start popping in and flooding the system with requests to take down specific accounts. Now, let me ask a question. What does the CIA do? Does anybody know?
Mess it up.
You mean like the stated purpose is intelligence operations versus other nations.
Outside of the United States.
Yes. So FBI.
That's the stated.
Right.
Thing.
That's the stated goal. Right. So FBI is supposed to be within the United States, and the CIA deals with threats from outside the United States. Okay, so so there we have it, right? Supposedly, ostensibly, okay? So next we get a picture of how it's not just Twitter. So here's an email from Cardillo to Baker, the head lawyer at that time, James Baker, and we all remember who he was before. He says, yeah, I invited the FBI and the CIA virtually, and the CIA will attend too, Cardillo says to Baker. No need for you to attend. So not only are they scheduling meetings to determine the outcomes at Twitter, they're telling the chief legal officer, you don't need to be there. We'll just do it all ourselves. So the thread goes on and on and on, but we get down to brass tacks when we show the list of accounts that they requested to take down, and there are thousands of them. And turns out they're all American citizens. The CIA is not living up to its mission. They are they were meddling in the last two elections, 2016 for sure. 2022 for sure, 2020 for sure. So that was a supplemental. So I want to read something that Matt Taibbi wrote. Where is it? Of course, I don't have it. Okay. I'm sorry. I apologize for not having it at my... So we got Twitter files part 7 and 8, and this one definitely, this one's about the Pentagon. Twitter has claimed for years that they make a concerted effort to detect and thwart government-backed platform manipulation. Here's Twitter testifying to Congress about the pledge to rapidly identify and shut down all state-backed covert information operations and deceptive propaganda. But behind the scenes, Twitter gave approval and special protection to the U.S. military. Listen to this. U.S. military's online psychological influence ops. Despite knowledge that the Pentagon propaganda accounts used covert identities, Twitter did not suspend many for around 2 years or more. Some remain active. Here's what they did. In 2017, right after the 2016 election, a U.S. Central Command CENTCOM official sent Twitter a list of 52 Arab language accounts that, quote, from the Pentagon, we use to amplify certain messages. So in this email, they're telling us that they have these accounts, these Twitter accounts, and they use them to amplify certain messages. In this case, it was to help start a war, or to continue a war. The same day CENTCOM sent the list, Twitter officials used a tool to grant a special whitelist tag that essentially provides verification status to the account without the blue check, meaning they're exempt from spam, abuse flags, more visible, likely to trend on hashtags. The CENTCOM accounts on the list tweeted frequently about U.S. military priorities in the Middle East, including promoting anti-Iran messages, promotion of the Saudi Arabia U.S.
Sorry, Heckelbird.
Heckelbird, U.S.-backed war in Yemen, and accurate U.S. drone strikes that claim to only hit terrorists. Yes.
Special drones.
Oh, my God.
They hug everyone else.
Mind-reading drones.
One Twitter official who spoke to me said he feels deceived by the covert shift. Still, many emails from throughout 2020 show that high-level Twitter executives were well aware of the Department of Defense's vast network of fake accounts and covert propaganda and did not suspend the account. For example, Twitter lawyer Jim Baker, here he is again, mused in July 2020 email about an upcoming DOD Department of Defense meeting that the Pentagon used poor tradecraft in setting up its network, and we're seeking strategies for not exposing the accounts that are linked to each other or to the DOG. So I'm saying all this to say that Danielle talks a lot about something called Project Mockingbird. Project Mockingbird was a CIA psyop that got set up in what year?
Oh, geez. That's a good question. I'm
like the
find
20s?
Out. No, because I think it was like the 50s.
Okay.
I think it was the 50s. Let's see. Project Mockingbird. Okay, it is. History, 1962.
Brief overview?
1962, yeah.
Brief overview?
Okay, it's basically the CIA infiltrating media organizations to place their propaganda messages and to make sure that the wrong or the correct information was not put out by these media sources. So started under Kennedy, and which is presumably one of the reasons that Kennedy wanted to, paraphrasing here, but smash the CIA into 1,000 pieces and scatter them to the winds. That and the Bay of Pigs incident. But basically they claim that it stopped, that this Operation Mockingbird stopped. But here it is alive and well, and the Twitter files are exposing it, which is pretty amazing stuff. Also, I want to talk about the psychological operations. Like, I can't even tell you how many times on Facebook, not necessarily as much on Twitter, but it did happen on Twitter. I would have somebody come in and say, you've lost it. You're just, this is, when I'm just posting information that's, it's generally readily available information if you just look at it from their own mouths, from their own websites. But when you post this information there's constantly somebody I assume that comes out and says, you've lost it. You've gone too far this time. You're just crazy. You need to get help. All of these things making you question your sanity. And so, for those of us who have been subject to this for years, even though we know that we were right and we, held fast to our convictions, it's really just nice to see it in writing, to see them actually right out in the open from Twitter. This is Elon Musk took over Twitter and started exposing them. And so from their own internal documents, as we were saying it, now we've got proof that at the same time, Twitter was in the background, doing exactly what we said that they were doing. And so that really is a comfort, I think, to a lot of people, these Twitter files in a lot of ways, because no, we're not crazy.
No, we're not. And I'd like to find it, because that is exactly what I'm going to finish up with. Matt Taibbi, he wrote a Substack, and what he said was, oh, no, it's not. Dang it.
Didn't you send it in Seeds of Change, right?
I thought I did. Anyway, the Substack basically...
No, that's not it?
That's not it.
Okay.
The Substack basically says that exactly what Danielle just highlighted. That this stuff, because all of us have been the normies or people that aren't freaking government agents, or have been sitting back going, how is this possible? Look at what these people are doing. And to a point where we're like feeling crazy, like no one will listen. No one cares. Why aren't they reporting on it? It's a Substack. It's not a Twitter thread.
Oh, okay.
And we're looking at our phones and we're going through and we're arguing with these bots that Danielle's talking about and the stuff that they're saying, cognitive dissonance. And you're like, you ask them, don't clear yourself. Look, we have the proof. And they're like, you're crazy. And so what Matt Taibbi said, that is the blessing. That is the good news of all these stuff, is because now we can sit back and go, I really was seeing what I was seeing, and I really deserved to feel the way that I felt. And we have the receipts now, and that's the good news.
Mm-hmm.
Moving on to, and this one's really cool. God bless it. And I did it again. Rogan O'Hanley is another, his handle is DC Drano. And he, is one of those ones that got kicked off of Twitter with me. He's a journalist, and now he's over on Truth Social. He got to do Twitter Files Part 9, and here we go with the elections. State governments also caught censoring election, in quotes, election misinformation using Twitter partner portal to unconstitutionally censor First Amendment rights of American citizens. So he DC Drano went on, got one of the Twitter files, and it looks like it's been deleted. Isn't that interesting? After all this time, I put it away to read it to you all. But so the example that he was using, which I'm still going to quote it, even though I can't find it, it's kind of odd. Katie Hobbs with the Arizona election was requesting people questioning her election tactics, and it went on and on. There was a bunch from California. There was a bunch from Pennsylvania. Interesting. From Georgia, and with requests by state officials to censor American citizens' voices during the election cycles, that when we were calling it, quote unquote, election misinformation.
Mm-hmm.
We have the receipts. That's the good news, is that they can't gaslight us. They're attempting to. Their gaslighting now is something a little less, you know, less fiery. They're just saying, well, we all knew that.
Yeah, we knew this already.
We've known this all along. This is old news. Let's move on. But 6 months ago, 8 months ago, a year ago, they were saying, you're crazy. You have no evidence of that, without evidence. That is, you know, most of the headlines from news articles.
Baseless
claims without evidence, and dismissing us that way. And it's just a pisser.
Yeah. I can't wait for the Fauci files to come out next. And, you know, something that you mentioned earlier, that if they'll do this, what else is it really that much of a stretch that they would, you know, release a virus? And, you know, it's interesting because it's not even the first time that they've done it. You know, there was Operation Sea Spray. Do you know about Operation Sea Spray?
I think I heard you mention it. Quick rundown.
I'm going to just look it up. I want to look up the year, because it was basically the government, Operation Sea Spray. In the 1950s, was a secret biological warfare experiment in which Sorrentia, it's a really long name for a bacteria, but it's a very specific bacteria, was sprayed in the fog over San Francisco Bay. They released it into this fog to see if they could get people sick, and it worked. And there was one in St. Louis where they did this, kind of a same kind of deal. Let me look up. And of course, there's always the Tuskegee experiments, right, where they, they had African-American men who they knew tested positive for syphilis, didn't treat them, but, you know, used them as a long-term study to see what would happen when syphilis remained untreated. They lived lives. They had children. They, you know, they had sex with their partners, and all along not knowing that they were infecting them. And let me see the one in St. Louis, biological warfare. In St. Louis. It's been a long time since I looked these up, but it's, here we go. Biological case. U.S. government released documents in 1994 revealing that they had sprayed zinc cadmium sulfide, a toxic substance, in St. Louis and other cities as part of a military experiment. They just keep doing this to us. And so when people are like, well, how could they ever? Oh, they did something in the light bulbs in New York City. They put some kind of substance in the light bulbs of New York City and smashed them in the subway to see if they would get people sick and see how transmissible it was. So to those people who are like, well, how could our government ever do this to us? Well, they have already done it to us, and they will continue doing it to us until we say enough is enough, until we actually, start to stand up for ourselves, because this is not the first nor the last time they'll do it.
So for my final, what's the word that I'm looking for? I'm having a
segment. Favorite.
Yeah, for my final item that I want to discuss, we have long mourned the loss of a kid named Seth Rich.
R.I.P. Seth Rich.
R.I.P. Seth Rich. So Seth Rich was a kid that worked for the DNC. Seth Rich was apparently dissatisfied, perhaps even pissed off at what he was seeing that was going on during the primaries with Bernie Sanders and Hillary Clinton. At some point, it appears, we think, we believe, here we go with those conspiracy theories, that Seth Rich transferred a bunch of data to an organization run by a gentleman named Julian Assange called WikiLeaks. And WikiLeaks dumped all that information onto the American public. It was about that time that this information was passed from who we believe was this kid, Seth Rich, to Julian Assange, that Seth Rich was murdered on the streets of Washington, D.C. The police opened and shut the case very quickly, called it a robbery, and then called it a botched robbery because his money, his watch, his phone, everything was still on him when they found him. He was still alive when they found him. They transferred him to the hospital. Uh-oh. Is that you, John?
Did I make a sound?
You did good, but there's maybe some background noise. I don't know. Maybe it's Danielle. Who knows? It's fine. I just was checking to see if you had a question or a comment. So that was
it was not so badly. It's like it almost just wasn't a robbery.
Yeah, almost. Yeah. Those are some pretty bad robbers.
So I suppose most of what I say, I have my tongue in cheek because I know he was murdered.
Mm-hmm. And he was, by the way, he was laughing, not laughing, but talking as he was being put into the ambulance.
Yeah.
He was conscious. He died in the hospital, and there's a lot of connections, you know, to Hillary Clinton and, you know, the DNC at that hospital. So that's really where, like, the out there kind of conspiracy theorists go, is that he was actually murdered in the hospital.
Yes. So as soon as the cops got a hold of the case and very quickly calling it a botched robbery attempt with murder, the FBI went in and took Seth Rich's laptop. And apparently his personal laptop is what we've been hearing all these years, that the cops took his laptop and they were fighting to keep a hold of this laptop. Apparently they took his work laptop as well. So someone has made it their personal mission in life to continue to fight for Seth Rich's information, that laptop, to FOIA it. And I guess they had another round here just the other day. So the FBI is insisting that they want to keep it the same way they did the JFK files, and they want to keep it for 75 years. And apparently we did another hearing about it. Sentinel. Let's see, hold on, is that the first page? It's only through discussions with the SA assisting RIDS to locate the work laptop that RIDS was able to determine that the report, letter from a third party, and chain of custody forms existed. So they have the laptop. All this time they've acted like they didn't have his quote-unquote work laptop. They admitted they had his personal laptop, which we don't know why. The FBI had it, okay? If it was just a botched robbery, why would they have his personal laptop, that chain of custody forms existed and were related to Seth Rich's work laptop. The SA advised RIDS, I have no idea what these acronyms stand for, that disclosure of these records would cause harm to an FBI investigation and Department of Justice prosecution of several employees of the government of the Russian Federation. So this is their latest gambit as to why they're keeping this information, is that supposedly they're in the process of trying to prosecute members of the Russian Federation, and that that's why we can't have it. This is their latest gambit, because they've been fighting for, you know, since Sethras was murdered in 2016. Was he murdered in 2015 or 2016?
16.
Yeah. And now they're saying that it would interrupt an FBI says an investigation into the Russian Federation. So this is their latest big fat lie, why they can't give this information to the public. And I think they're full of shit. That's just my, So there we go.
I thought that they hacked the DNC server. Nobody said anything about, I mean, that Mueller report was all about this Russian hacking.
Okay. So we have what they say, which mm-hmm. we know is baloney, but I'll read it. In around 2016, the Russian Federation, Russia, operated a military intelligence agency now called the Main Directorate of the General Staff of the Armed Forces of the Russian Federation, then known as the Main Intelligence Directorate and still commonly known by the abbreviation GRU, the Russian abbreviation of, and I'm not going to read the Russian words. That, in short, is the Foreign Military Agency of the General Staff of the Russian Armed Forces. The GRU had militant multiple units, including units 26165 and 74455, engaged in cyber operations that involved the staged releases of documents stolen through computer intrusions. These units included large-scale cyber operations to interfere with the 2016 U.S. presidential election. So they're still sticking to the story that the information that was released through WikiLeaks was Russian propaganda.
Uh-huh.
And it wasn't. It was not. As a matter of fact, the belief is that Seth Rich downloaded it onto a thumb drive and gave it to Julian Assange, who is not a Russian operative. He's just WikiLeaks.
Right.
He's a journalist.
Exactly. And it's WikiLeaks, not WikiHacks. So it's not like this is not a hacking operation. So it's very interesting that they're still sticking to this, even though that, you know, we've got all of the receipts that they were the ones interfering in the election and not Russia.
So the editorializing by Technofog, who is an account that I follow very closely on Telegram, says, interesting to say the least, admission from the FBI concerning a second Seth Rich laptop in its possession. Seth Rich's work laptop is held by the FBI as part of evidence against Russian intelligence for interfering with the 2016 U.S. presidential election. Because the work laptop is part of a pending case that will never be tried, the Russians aren't coming to the U.S. anytime soon. It is essentially buried from the public view for the foreseeable future. Reminiscent of how the FBI buried Igor Danchenko, the steel primary subsource, as a confidential human resource. As to Seth Rich's personal laptop, the FBI is still fighting the production of that information. So I am going to sign off for today. Merry Christmas to everyone who is listening. I just want to know if anybody has any questions or comments about the information that I was able to share today.
And by anybody, she means John.
Right.
Yeah. Questions? No. I think it's pretty, like as always, you lay it out pretty well. And it's hard to have any questions because you kind of answered everything.
But how about comments? Don't you want to say, these MFers, son of a biscuit-eating, dirty scumbag, jerk-faced, butthead? Isn't that what you wanted to say?
There's a time in my life where I would have wanted to say that, but I think I'm a bit desensitized at this point. I kind of been through
that.
That's
sad. Me too.
Probably back in 2012, because I was following the Ron Paul campaign, and I saw how the media sort of buried him using a lot of different dirty tricks, and it was really disgusting to watch.
Yes.
And I kind of burned out. Like, I'm a little bit I guess, jaded now, and maybe a little black build on it.
Yeah.
So, so I don't even get emotional about it anymore.
No, and you know what? Perhaps I don't either, but I still am. I'm still passionate to make sure that I keep shouting and telling the truth, and I know you do too. You probably, in passing with folks that you visit with and your truck driver buddies, and you tell them, oh, yeah, did you hear about the something, right? So just keep informing, right?
Right. Yeah, well, what else can you do? And, you know, I don't have a lot of faith that things are going to turn around, but, I mean, there are things you can do to sort of prepare and adapt. I really think that's probably the best strategy going forward. And
so,
it's definitely good to hear all this coming out, for sure.
If you would have asked me a year ago, I would have agreed with you. I see the light at the end of the tunnel. That's just my opinion.
Yeah, well, I mean, that'd be great. I mean, we'll see, and I hope that's the case. I really do. So, and I got to operate as if I have a future. So, I mean, you can't assume you don't have a future. Like, what's the point in that? So, have the optimistic, you know, the future is going to be all right, and it's coming and whatnot. So,
yes.
I mean, I do have some concerns about next year, but I think we're doing good news because it's Christmas Day, so I don't want to rain on the parade.
Yeah, but I think we're definitely going to have to closely read the terms of service for 2023 before we sign up for anything.
Yes. I don't want to renew my subscription.
Yeah, my mom, I don't know if you can hear her. She's kind of far away, but she doesn't know she wants to renew her subscription.
Oh, yeah. No, she came in just fine. I that's a good one.
That's a good one. Okay, well.
Have a Merry Christmas, and we'll see you, what, next year?
Yeah, no, do we have one more?
Oh, yeah, I guess so. Well, it's the 23rd.
Let's see.
Is it New Year's Eve next Sunday? Or is it New Year's Day? I can never remember.
It's the last show of the year.
Goodbye, 2022.
Adios.
I will not miss you.
Adi freaking os.
Yeah, I missed 2019, 2017, 2016.
Yeah.
Good year. But all the right people were triggered and crying and... It was very satisfying.
It was a little satisfying, that's for sure.
Yeah.
And, you know, back then I was still a Bernie supporter, right? So it's not like I was like, oh, yeah, you know, Trump won, yay, you know. I was just happy that Hillary lost.
Oh, yeah. And to watch all those people cry was pretty amazing. I probably should be like
fun.
That.
That was fun.
Oh, yeah. Like, literally cry. Like, they're always, it was the salt mines of 2020 or 2016.
Yeah, there you go.
Sorry, my mom's leaving, so she's got to get back on the road. Carl's dead, so my husband's packing him up some leftovers. What did you guys do for Christmas?
Well, so we had this blizzard, right? Not today, but Friday. And I went to work anyway because the way the policy works at my job is that if I don't come to work the day before a holiday, I don't get the holiday day, right?
Oh, okay.
If I would have called in Friday, I would have lost holiday pay for Christmas Eve, and then they probably wouldn't have had me in Christmas Eve,
mm-hmm.
and because I worked third shift, so I probably would have also lost the holiday pay for Christmas Day. And I'm like, yeah, I don't know if I can afford that. So I just took my time, and my normally hour and a half drive to get, you know, to work was probably about 3 hours. And then and I drove through the blizzard in the truck, and that 4.5-hour drive was 8 or 9 hours.
Oh,
I did it. And that was Friday night. Yeah, it got so bad. Like, it was whiteout conditions at some points. I was down to, like, 5 miles an hour, you know, just kind of chugging along just to get through some of the parts. there are a lot of trucks on the side of the road and cars and everything, but generally, you know, if you take it slow, you get through and be cautious, and that's what I did. So I got out there, and I drove to Wisconsin Friday night, right? And then Saturday night, of course, I had to drive back home and drive through it again. It wasn't as bad last night, but so I drove through it again to get home. And then and I got home this morning about, I don't know, 10 a.m. or so, and then my brother called me up. He's like, hey, you're coming, right? And I was like, yeah, I'm coming. So I get there, you know, I hadn't slept or anything and had dinner or lunch, I guess, whatever you would call it. And I did the gifts and everything, and then I fell asleep for a few hours.
Oh, that sounds like at least a relaxing thing.
Yeah, it was all right. I don't have any complaints. I'm not a big holiday person personally, so, like, if whatever happens, I'm just pretty much okay with it. I don't have big expectations about it or anything, so.
You know, I was never a Christmas person either. You know, especially, like, you know, we've got a shared past when it comes to, you know, the Christians and pointing out the hypocrisy. But so I was never really a
Christian.
But I didn't really like that. I didn't like that there was a day that I could be, you know, grumpy when everybody else is so happy. So so I got married on Christmas Day. And so today's also my anniversary. And now it's a completely different meeting.
Yeah, something to celebrate.
Yeah,
it's
exactly.
A good one.
So,
well,
so this is
I
our...
mean, if nothing else, it's a sort of opportunity or whatever to get together with your family and everything. So, I mean, I don't think that's ever really a bad thing.
Exactly, so. Yeah. So I just turned it into something nice.
Call your mom.
Yeah.
Call her?
Yeah.
What?
Oh,
okay. Well, I'm on the show. My husband's like, call your mom. She forgot something. I'm like, well, I'm so busy.
You're gonna have to wait.
Anyway, but yeah, it was small. Actually, the kids are even gone. They're in, they're in Las Vegas right now. They left for Texas, that's where their dad lives, and they did a little holiday trip to Vegas. So I don't even have the kids for Christmas. So my mom came down, and a friend of the family, Jack, came down too, and we just had. We didn't do a turkey. We did a chicken and we did carnitas and they were really, really good. So, I prefer chickens because like you don't go into that food coma afterwards like you do with turkey.
Oh, okay. Yeah. I went into a lack of sleep coma, but yeah.
Ah. Yeah. And driving in snow.
Yeah, no, I hear what you're saying though.
That scares the crap out of me. I've never driven in snow. And don't know if I ever want to.
I don't know that I'd recommend that for you. You lived in California all or most of your life, right?
Yes, yeah.
Yeah,
but
I
do have the car for it. You know, I do have a decent car. It's got, all-wheel drive or something. It's not four-wheel drive, but it's something. Maybe it is four-wheel drive. Actually, I don't even know. My husband.
Get somebody else to drive for you.
Yes,
now, if you move somewhere where it snows, that's different. But if you're just visiting, let somebody else drive.
Yeah, exactly.
You don't want to
take care of every once in a while. Babe, what's the car that it's not four-wheel drive, is it? Yeah, it is? X-Drive. It's a BMW X5.
I drive a little Aveo.
Oh, my God.
It's not a good snow car. At all.
That would scare me.
But, yeah, and when I was driving out there, it wasn't snowing at first where I live, but it had been, and the wind was really high, and there's all these cornfields and everything. So there were these huge snowdrifts on the road that I had to kind of plow through in my little Chevy Aveo. I did all right, though. It's a stick shift, so I was able to kind of gear down when I needed to and kind of power through. And I took it slow. And that's the biggest thing is just take it slow, give yourself plenty of time to stop, that kind of thing. Never slam the brakes, never slam the accelerator.
Yeah, okay, I should take him.
Then, yeah. And then if you start to slide, what I do is I always take my foot off the gas pedal and just kind of try to gently steer, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And usually that'll get me back on, keep me going good. But it's really just experience more than anything.
It doesn't really make me nervous, but... Yeah, so it doesn't really matter what kind of car you have, you know, as long as you've got the experience, which is why even though I have the right car for snow, I'd probably still be screwed.
Yeah, I don't know. I don't know if I do it. Like, I mean, if you moved to a snowy place, you'd just have to do it, right? But if you're just visiting, I'd say get an Uber or something or have a friend drive you.
Right, or have somebody drive my, my very capable car.
There you go. Although I'd be very surprised if you visited somewhere in the winter that is cold.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, last year
we went to
Nashville for Christmas and to visit Joe's dad, and we got into actually on the way back we stayed all the way through New Year's, and on the way back we got we hit a little bit of snow in Arkansas, but I wasn't driving.
Oh, okay.
And yeah, but it was really interesting because, like, well, I expected some colder weather, right? Because it's Nashville. I don't know, but it was the same. Actually, it was colder here in San Diego at that time than it was in Nashville. We brought the weather with us, I guess.
Huh. Weird.
Yeah.
Did you take the I-70? I think that's one that goes through Denver.
No.
And all that?
No, we went the lower one. We did the 10.
Yeah, that's probably a good idea in the winter. I don't recommend the mountains in the winter.
On the way there, we went through, we went a little bit higher elevation. We went up like north of Phoenix and drove through some really spectacular mountains in Arizona. And then we came down, that might have been the 70, and we came down through Albuquerque,
No, I think the 70, if I remember correctly, goes through Denver when you go out of the mountains.
Oh, okay. So it's the one in the middle then, right? In between the 10 and the 70?
Yeah, I don't know. I'd have to look it up. But I think I know what you're talking about, because I once, when I was over the road a few years ago, I went through New Mexico to California. So it was probably the same road, but I don't think it was a freeway. I don't think it was like an interstate. It was a different route. I have to Google map it and find it. I know Google's all evil and everything. Like, oh, Google Maps.
Yeah.
Still a good
program.
It gets
me to where I need to go, though, right?
Yeah. It's good.
Yeah.
It's good for the roads.
Yeah. And I mean, I really would love to go up to Big Bear. Like, that sounds like a lot of fun, and stay up in a cabin. But that's about as far as I'd want to go. Oh, the 40.
It's the
I-40
that goes through Albuquerque. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I think that's the one that we did.
Yeah, probably. Because it goes straight into Tennessee, I think, yeah.
Okay. Yeah, that's where we went.
And all that.
Yeah, but...
Yep.
But I've actually been enjoying, like, trolling everybody with all their freezing temperatures and stuff. I'm like, oh, my gosh.
I think
almost too cold to wear flip-flops. Like, but it was a gorgeous day. Like, everybody's. Right now it's currently 71 degrees.
Yeah. Well, that's all right, because when it gets warmer, then what I'll be trolling you about the fact that we have endless supplies of water, because we live in the middle of I think 20% of the world's fresh water supply.
That's actually bragging rights, for sure.
Yeah. So, you know, there's always drawbacks and everything, so.
Right, and you guys don't burn down annually. And you guys don't burn down annually.
Right. Nope. Yeah, then Michigan is really kind of tame. It's just, like, we get some bad winters sometimes, but as far as natural disasters go, there's not a whole lot up here.
Mm-hmm.
It's cold, snowy winters sometimes. And sometimes they get mild winters, but then that has some bad effects too, because then, like, the bees are really bad. A couple years ago, we had a mild winter. The bees?
Mm-hmm.
Because the what happens is at the end in the fall, the queen bees, the new queen bees, get knocked up, and then they go hide somewhere for the winter, right? And usually a lot of them die off, but if you have a mild winter, you don't get that, you know, less of them die off. So then the following spring, you end up with lots of bees because the queens all survived, or not enough of them died off, you know. And we had them real bad in the house. They had gotten into the walls somehow, and we had to get an exterminator and everything.
Oh, yikes.
So these mild winters bring problems too, but overall, I appreciate mild winters.
Yeah. Something that, like, people don't really think about when they move here is that our fleas, you know, like fleas on a dog, we have, like, super fleas here because they never die, right? They never freeze off in the wintertime. And they just become, like, just resistant to size and things like that because we don't have a frost here. So, yeah, it definitely has its drawbacks.
Yeah. Yeah, and I like San Diego, but, you know, I don't know. And it's so expensive there. Like, I don't know. I like having my disposable income, too. But, I mean, I thought of moving, because there are warmer places I could live that would be pretty reasonable, you know, priced and whatnot as far as cost of living. But moving is such a pain when you own a house. And you got to get it all fixed up and find somebody to buy it and all that. Like, it's a pain in the butt, so.
Yeah, I can see that.
Plus, I've got so many friends and family here. Like, it's kind of hard for me to want to move.
Right, the support network is really important. And that's kind of like what we were thinking. It's like we could pick up and buy, you know, two houses for, you know, maybe three houses for what we could sell our little farm for in Carlsbad. But there, it comes with no support network. It, you know, everything that we've built up here, we would have to do again there, you know, wherever
sure,
we left. You know, and so, I don't know, and the property taxes, although property taxes are, you know, lower in a lot of places, we have, like, original 1970s property taxes on our farm. And they just don't,
like,
people paid, you know, triple, quadruple the amount of property taxes right across the street from us because of the, you know, because this has been in our family since it was the sketch on the back of a truck. So,
nice.
You know, all of these things to consider. And every once in a while when Newsom does something really crazy, we're like, all right, where are we moving? You know, but it just doesn't really make sense.
Yeah,
you know?
It's tough. Well, and, you know, Newsom, whatever his name is temporary. I mean, he's going to be gone. I mean, not that I have a lot of faith in Californians to elect anyone decent, but, you know, there'll be somebody else eventually. And, you know, and that property you've got is something that's permanent.
Exactly.
So giving that up for a temporary problem is not necessarily worth it.
Right, yeah. I've got the mayor of Carlsbad's phone number, and when I call, he picks up. You know what I mean? Like, those kind of connections.
That's cool.
Well, because I've known him since I was a kid. His wife is my grandma's best friend. One of my grandma's best friends.
Very cool.
Yeah, so.
Very cool. Yeah, that doesn't come easily, that kind of connection, that's for sure. Although I found lately I've been very good at meeting people and whatnot. I've gotten a lot more sociable.
Oh, that's awesome.
Yeah. Yeah, I don't know if I want to tell all the details. Maybe someday I will. But I've had some experiences in the last couple months, and I've had a lot easier time talking to people I don't know and, like, having a better attitude and things like that. Yeah, and I found a way to kind of overcome, because I used to have, I think, a lot of social anxiety. And, like, this thing, little thing going on in my brain is, like, people don't want to talk to you, you know. People don't want to hear what you have to say. And that's, it's kind of, like, I don't have a lot of anxiety, like, about my body or about being afraid of, like, I don't fear things too much. I think partially because I've been to war, but if I do, if I have some social anxiety, right, that's where mine is. But, you know, I've been really kind of overcoming that, and I found a way to sort of do that. And like I said, I don't know if you want to share it on here. So I'm going to keep it to myself for now.
It's up to you, really. I mean, we've got plenty of time.
Well, it's not exactly Christian, so I mean, maybe I could put it that way.
Okay, well, that's...
Maybe I should tell you ahead of time.
Okay, yeah, whatever makes you comfortable. I've always been a social butterfly. Running for Congress definitely elevated that. So that's not really a problem that I've ever had.
Yeah. All right. Okay. Well, it sounds like you're pretty open here. I don't know how family friendly that the show is. So
if it's sexual, then you know maybe use some code words. But other than that.
Yeah. Oh. Okay. Well, I'll just say a friend of mine was in town, and we didn't have anything to do. We wanted to do some karaoke, but there's no karaoke on that particular day. So we went to a gentleman's club. I can say that, right? Like, that's
sure.
Cool. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
All right. And it was really kind of a unique situation because, like, I kind of got, like, immediately infatuated there, I guess would be the word I would use.
Mm-hmm.
And I kept going back, which I've always had a problem with. Like, I always, like, I meet somebody I like, and then I just go overboard with the feelings, right? And usually that, like, no one wants that. Like, it chases people away. But since this person is works at the place, I can just keep coming back, right? Now, which sounds awful on the face of it. But so, you know. But the thing is, what that allowed me to do was to kind of work through that sort of infatuation thing in an environment where there's boundaries that are built in because it's only happening there. And it's not even as bad as it sounds because I didn't really do like a lot of sexual stuff there that you would expect, but it was more just hanging out there, talking to someone that was attracted to and had like the whatever infatuation thing. Under the conditions that nothing ever is going to happen or come out of it, right? And
that's
having
actually
done
pretty brilliant.
That.
That's actually pretty brilliant.
Yeah, yes. And it was really amazing. Like, and I would go out of there just, and usually all I would do is just have a conversation and I would still pay her because, you know, she's there spending her time, right?
Mm-hmm.
And I would just tell her my feelings because you can, because they don't care. They're just there to get paid. So you can tell them whatever they want. You want, pretty much, which is a pretty rare opportunity because I can tell her whatever I want and there's not going to be any rejection because it's about, you know, it's a job. So she's there to get paid. And so having been able to have that opportunity and then ultimately kind of overcoming the nervousness and overcoming the intimidation factor of it, of being around someone I'm really attracted to. And I hate to say I have feelings for because it seems silly, but I think a lot of people go through this where they meet someone and for some reason, like, they just get this, it's like they're immediately infatuated for whatever reason. Like, I don't fully really understand how that works, but it definitely happens. And then you're nervous around the person and everything. But being able to just keep going, keep having conversations, and learn to be cool with that and whatnot, it very much did a lot to help me overcome my social anxiety and find out that, people will talk to me. And I found out that the women that work there are actually, like, they are kind of picky in a way, like they choose their customers, I guess you would say.
Mm-hmm.
And so there is also like some kind of selection process. It's not all just, oh, this person has money and there you go. It's like, there's more to it than that. But anyway, and that's what I did
that's
for a while.
The therapist,
I,
too.
Yeah, it is therapeutic, kind of. I actually looked it up. I was reading an article on the internet that was saying it's a natural way to get dopamine, serotonin, and increase testosterone levels for men, which
that'll make perfect sense.
Yeah. So that was the experience. I was hesitant to share it because I didn't know, like, how the show is or whatever, if that would be a bad thing to put on the show. So.
No,
but,
yeah.
Like,
I love it. I'm glad you shared.
Yeah. So it was, it gave me a lot of confidence, gave me a lot of, definitely a mood booster. And also just getting over the social anxiety about talking to, because to me, the most intimidating person to talk to would be an attractive woman that I like. Like, there's nothing more intimidating. I mean, maybe not now, because I kind of overcame it, but before. But the thing is, like, if that's the most intimidating social thing, person to talk to, and I can overcome that, then I can talk to anybody.
Exactly.
Anyone else. Right. So that's kind of how I explain the experience that I've had recently with that. It's really changed my life a lot. I mean, to be honest, I don't think I would have been as good of a guest here had I not gone through that experience before you got a hold of me.
Yeah.
So.
Well, one of my favorite scriptures is all things work for the good who love God and are called according to his purpose. So, even if people have judgmental thoughts, it's all going to work out, for his good and his glory anyway. So it doesn't matter where you meet people, as
right.
long as your heart's in the right place. So no,
as long as it's consenting adults, but I don't have any problem.
Yeah.
So, yeah. So yeah, that's my, gentleman's club story. You would say, that's what they call it. So,
yeah.
And it's not something I think I'd really generally recommend for guys to do, because I think that there were a lot of unique circumstances that made it work for me. So,
mm-hmm.
and a lot of it could have gone very badly. I could have, if I didn't have more self-control, I could have just blown a bunch of money and not been able to pay my bills. I could have gotten into financial trouble. It could have
mm-hmm.
gone bad in a lot of ways. I don't recommend someone just kind of try that unless you have some self-control. That's very important. So,
right.
I kind of want to write a short book, not book, I guess it'd be more of a pamphlet or something, basically on how to lay out what happened and how, because I think a lot of, I don't think it would work for women so much, because women work a little differently, but maybe for men that have a lot of social anxiety and especially trouble talking to women, just lay out the whole experience and how you can use that to sort of overcome that anxiety and be more confident and sociable.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't know if I'm at the point where I'm ready to do that, but I have been kind of mulling that over. I think it could be useful. But
yeah, I think so.
Like I said, there's a lot of pitfalls too, so that you have to watch out for.
Mm-hmm.
And another thing I've learned from the whole experience is just to kind of, when I talk to people, and something I had a lot of trouble with was just kind of enjoying the conversation or appreciating the, or if I talk to a woman that I kind of like, maybe kind of a little bit or something, but just kind of enjoy that sort of, I call it a buzz that you can get going sometimes without any
mm-hmm.
expectation of getting a phone number or any, of anything happening after that, just kind of enjoying the thing that's happening right now, without trying for more. And appreciating,
right. Letting the connection be what it is and not expecting anything
right.
else.
Yeah. And I think what we tend to do is when there's some kind of connection with someone, I think we tend to have these sort of boxes that we have to put it in. So a friend box or a love interest box or, you know, and then that really kind of messes things up because then you think, oh, this is somebody that's a love interest, but maybe it's somewhere in between or it's something like more nuanced that's not really anything that you can divine very well. But then you try to define it anyway. Yeah, just let it be. Just let it be and enjoy it for what it is. And I think that if you can do that, and it's not easy to do, it's very hard to do. You got to kind of reprogram your mind. But if you can do that, I think that it also circumvents a lot of, like, sadness. Like, because then if things don't, because you don't have, like, a sense of where you want something to go, so you don't have that sadness when from rejection because you were just enjoying the thing that was there, not the thing that you wanted to happen or something like that or that you thought it was.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that'd make people's lives a lot better to be able to do that. It's made my life better so far. So
excellent.
Yeah. But it's also very important. You got to really be honest with yourself and honest with the people around you too. Because otherwise, and because we tend to lie to ourselves. I mean, I know that, I don't know. I think that's very common. And we tend to lie to ourselves without even realizing it about maybe what we're feeling or about what's going on to make yourself feel better or like in many ways. So it's important to self-reflect and be very honest with yourself so that whatever feeling you're having in the situation, maybe you can't define it, but you can kind of identify it and feel it for what it is and not for what you want it to be or something like that.
Right.
I don't know if that was very clear.
That takes a lot of communication with your subconscious. Like a lot of people don't really have that kind of connection with their subconscious, so it's easier for them to lie to each other or to themselves. And, And there's somebody in chat. So hello, Doreen. Welcome. Merry Christmas.
Oh, somebody else is on?
Well, so there's a chat feature on and so somebody just joined in there. So, yeah, I like to give a little shout out if I see people.
Right. Oh, that's cool. And because you can only be as honest with the world as you are with yourself. You can't be more honest with others than you are with yourself because when you lie to yourself, like, you can't tell a truth that you don't know.
Right.
So that's where it starts.
Mm-hmm.
But I think everyone does it to some degree, and it's a matter of minimizing that.
Yes.
Just figuring it out and minimizing it. And usually, if you're having a lot of problems in your life, usually somewhere, and I don't mean problems like, I mean, shit always happens, but like if your life is kind of a wreck and you're always upset and things like that, I would say there's probably somewhere inside where you're not being honest with yourself about your situation, about your responsibility, about, about the evil that's inside. And that's a big problem because there's this false dichotomy that people have where either there's no evil in me and I'm good, or there is evil in me and I'm evil. But people are complicated. So, and everyone has evil in them. And if you try to, and you got to kind of accept that and be like, okay, there's this evil thing in me, but that's not me and I'm not evil. It's a part of me, but it doesn't make me evil just because I have something evil in me. That's kind of hard to do.
Well, and I think that everybody needs to realize that there's a polarity and, you know, that good could not exist without evil and vice versa. And it's just keeping it in its proper place that that's the trick. And it's basically, principles of natural law that, if there's good, there's going to be evil. And it's really just how you interface with it that makes, you know, that makes you evil or makes you good.
Mm-hmm. Sure, yeah. So usually I think, people don't want to look at the evil that's inside them because of that, because they think, they recognize that there's this evil thing in them, whatever it's going to be, and it's different for everybody, but everybody's got it. If they acknowledge that it's there, then they're like, oh, then I must be evil or something, and so they kind of cover it up with pretty lies about themselves and about their lives, and that makes your life very discordant and very... And you end up running into a lot of problems with that. You do things and you don't quite understand why. You end up making rationalizations that don't really make a lot of sense, but you make it work. And you just end up with your psyche being this sort of mess, tangled mess of rationalization and just looking away from things. That's a bad way to put it.
I get
you. So anyway... It makes your mind like a jumbled mess and discordant. So,
and it's very difficult to once you realize that there is something going on, that you have possibly been lying to yourself. It is a lot of times so tangled. I think of it like a strand of Christmas, or several strands of Christmas lights, right? And you just take them down one year, you throw them in the garage, and the next year you get them out, and it's such a tangled mess. You just don't quite know where to start, where to pull first,
Oh, go ahead.
No, go ahead.
And then if you take that analogy further, say you've got that tangled mess of Christmas lights, right? And then you go to get your Christmas lights, and you're like, oh, that's such a mess. I don't even want to start with that. You don't know where to start. So you go out and buy a whole new string of lights.
I was just about to say that.
Throw that in with the other one. Oh, I'm sorry.
No, you're right. Yeah. But it's exactly right. And then you throw more on top, and then the next year it gets even worse. And then there's also this element of this generational trauma that a lot of people don't quite ever break. Right. So people are healing ancestral wounds right now, and so we're talking about or not, exactly, or just being a hot mess.
Yeah, and I think that it's important to sort out that mess before you have kids, which, I mean, I'm a bit of a hypocrite saying that, because I don't know that I fully had, but I think I'm doing pretty well at this point. But it's important to do, because you pass it on to them if you don't. You don't want to pass something like that on to your kids.
And it's really interesting because, I set my expectations of being a parent, to one standard, basically, and it's to be a better parent than either of mine. And to be honest, that bar is set pretty low because both of my parents were not around when I was a child. So for me to be a better parent than mine, I'm all aces. I'm here. I've got my children, and they're steady, and they've got everything that they need. And so for me, I just, the bar was set pretty low, but I think that I've gone quite above and beyond my expectations as a parent. And hopefully, these generational wounds will just continue to heal. And by the time they're having children, hopefully the family generational ancestral trauma will be gone with the next generation. And I'm really proud of a lot of people that I see, whether it be people in my just in my real life, everyday life, or people that I'm seeing online working on their traumas and acknowledging it first and foremost, that they've got traumas. I'm really proud of my friends. I'm really proud of how many people I'm seeing wake up every day to what we have to do to heal, not only as individuals, but as community, as a whole, as the collective.
Yeah. And kept me in. I had something I wanted to say, but I think it slipped my mind now.
Oh, sorry.
No, that's all right. I had another thought, and then I kind of pushed the other one out. Happens all the time. Oh, I remember. Okay.
Oh, yay.
Generational curses are a real thing. That's what I was going to say. And I think that's the core of what a generational curse is. The Bible talks about that. And it's not magic. It's not like God's cursing you and punishing you for your parents, what your parents did. It's just sort of baked into the human experience.
Yeah.
It's not like mystical or magical. And that's something, too, I like to kind of try to do is demystify the Bible, because I think a lot of what God or what the Bible is describing isn't like God doing things with magic or whatever and just saying stuff and making it happen. I think a lot of it is just baked in to reality and to the human experience. And it's just describing what it is to be a human. And I think when you look at the, I don't know if you, when the Bible is telling you how to act or how to conduct your life, I think that's more about telling you how, it's kind of like saying, okay, you're a human being. And so God knows what a human being is because he made you. And God knows how the world is. And what he's doing is revealing and telling you how to live life as a human, that live a life as a human that will be fulfilling and will bless you just by the nature of how the world works and how humanity, the human beings work. So, because people like to turn it into like, well, if you don't follow what God says, then he punishes you and whatnot. Like it's an active thing, like a parent child kind of a thing. But I think it's more of this is just how the world is and how people are, and it's just informing you and telling you, like, look, live like this, and then you'll, like, this is how you have a fulfilling life in creation, more so than you better do what I say or I'm going to punish you, you know. So.
Right. Well, I think that's where religion comes in, right? They try to use that, you know, that book and quote unquote God to keep people enslaved, honestly. And so they take it and they misinterpret it and they use it for their advantage, which is a huge problem in the Bible, right? Like for instance, when, you know, the Bible says that if you're going to, be the leader of a church, you need to have, you need to be the husband of at least one wife. There's, you know, a debate on whether it's one wife or at least one wife. You know, be sober, virtuous, you know, all of these things, these characters, characteristics that the leaders of church have to have. And, you know, it really is because if you're going to be the head of a church, a head of a community, basically, you need to at least know how to run a household, right? You need to be in control of your house before you can, you know, spiritually advise a community, right? So,
before
back in the day,
God's house.
Right,
you know,
exactly.
You
so back in the day,
the
Catholic Church would put parishes in the name of the priest in charge, and you know, and so just, you know, before, you know, the mail system, and you would have to write to the Vatican to get a fence mended, right? That would take months and months and months. If it was just in the priest's name, then that kind of expedited the whole process. But these priests were getting married and having children and then willing church property off to their families.
And
we know how that ended up. So the Catholic Church loses money. And so they're like, okay, well, you're married to Jesus now. And I really think that perversion of that scripture really did lead to the massive pedophilia issue with the Catholic Church because of that.
Repressed.
Yep.
Yeah.
All in the interest of
money.
A lot
of repressed sexuality and it seems like they could have set it up so that they weren't able to pass it down to their kids and just left it at that, but.
Yeah.
But They didn't do that, so there you go. They just decided they'd keep the property. Yeah, no, I am familiar with that story. I don't remember where I heard it, but I would take that principle all the way to heaven too. What I was talking about with instead of punishment, it's just, you know, this is how things are. I would take that all the way to the end in the kingdom of heaven, because we know that. I think the only being that the Bible specifically names that will be cast into hell is Lucifer, that I know of, right? I can't think of anyone else specifically named that is going to be cast into the lake of fire. And why, right? And it's because Lucifer rebelled against God. And Jesus says in the Bible, he says that a kingdom divided against itself cannot stand. Or he may have said a house divided against itself cannot stand, I think, when the Pharisees or Sadducees or something were accusing him of casting out demons by the power of demons. Mm-hmm. So he said that, and that's true. So you can't really exist in the kingdom of heaven if you're going to divide the kingdom against itself. That doesn't work. So if you have eternal life, but you can't submit to the will of God, then you can't really be in heaven, because the kingdom divided itself, or because the house divided against itself cannot stand. Because, for instance, I'm not saying this would happen, but if someone were to get into the kingdom or die, and you know they're standing before judgment or whatever, and God or Jesus or whoever's there says, look, it's okay to be gay, right? I'm not saying that would happen. I'm just off-the-wall example, right? Mm-hmm. And if someone said, well, I can't accept that, like being gay is so bad and it's awful, I don't think that person can be in the kingdom of heaven, because then they're dividing heaven, you know, against itself by saying, you know, can't have gay people here, whatever. You're gay, being gay is awful. And I'm not saying that would happen. I mean, I know that there are things in the Bible saying not to use, like it's wrong for a man to use another man, and I get that. But I think ultimately, if you can't submit to the will of God in all ways, then you can't really be in the kingdom of heaven. And if you have eternal life and you can't be in the kingdom of heaven, like, you got to go somewhere. So there aren't a whole lot of options at that point.
Right.
So I think that's... I don't think hell, the lake of fire, is so much about punishment as it is about, well, you know, you just can't be in the kingdom of heaven if you're going to divide against itself. And this goes back to the cult days, the Christian Universal Life teachings, where people did not innately have eternal life, I think, was the what we were on. So if you accept Christ as your Savior, all that, the Bible promises you eternal life. So So if you're saved by the graces of God and by the blood of Christ, you have eternal life.
Mm-hmm.
But what happens when someone has eternal life, but at the same time doesn't want to submit to the will of God? Can they really exist in the kingdom of heaven? And we know that, I don't remember the verse, but... there's a verse where people come before Christ and say, have I not done miracles in your name and cast out demons and all of this? So these are obviously people that believe in Jesus and believe in God. And Jesus says to them, go away from me, you worker of iniquity, for I never knew you. So that seems to me as a pretty solid example that there are people who are believers, but at the same time aren't going to be tolerated in the kingdom of heaven, because they're probably not, you know, submitting to the will of God.
Agreed.
So anyway, yeah. So I never liked this whole golden ticket thing, partially because of that, but also because so if it's the deal that, okay, if you don't believe, then you go to hell, right? Mm. So basically God is looking for people who are just afraid to go to hell for his kingdom, which seems kind of silly to me. Like, Yeah, I don't think God wants people that are just afraid to go to hell. Like, I think he wants people that submit to his will and live the kind of life that he's laid out for them.
Yeah, I agree. I do actually think though that there's two kinds of death in the Bible.
Mm-hmm.
There's grave or tomb, and then there's a fiery death, right? And mm-hmm. when they're, you know, atheists, like when they say that they think that when they die they stay dead, circle of life, they're right according to the Bible that if you don't believe, then you just die.
Mm-hmm.
And ashes to ashes, whatever. But then there's another kind of death, and that's I believe specifically reserved for Christians who do it wrong.
Who won't submit to the will of God? Yeah.
Exactly. Yeah. No matter what, right? Like I use the head covering as a good example, right? That I know that I should be wearing my head covered when I pray, and I'm supposed to pray without stopping. And so. Mm-hmm. You know, when I know that that's a sin, and I ask forgiveness for that sin, right? But the people who are like, oh, well, that doesn't apply anymore. That was for another people. That blah blah blah. You know, all of those are the people who are never going to ask forgiveness because they don't think that they did anything wrong. And so I think that those are the people who are going to, you know, go basically. I don't like the term hell, but they're going to be separated from God. And they're not going to understand why. And I think that is really the eternal hell, the eternal tortures being separated from, you know, the love of God and not even
having
knowing
eternal
why.
Life.
Yeah, and not
right.
knowing
God
why.
God promised you eternal life. You can't go back on his word. But I think, like, what it comes down to is, like, in the end, like, you're standing. So we have the death and the resurrection. So if you're, I guess, saved, however you want to say it, you die and then later on you're resurrected. And I've been knocked unconscious a couple times in my life, right? And
mm-hmm.
what happened was I had lost time. Like, so I was doing whatever. Then I was unconscious. The next thing I knew, people were standing around me. And I think that's what dying is like with the resurrection. Is that no time passes from your perspective. It's like you die, and then the next thing you know, if you're a believer, you're being raised from the dead, Christ has returned, and then everything's sorted out, and it's a matter of once you're in the presence of Christ, in the presence of God, can you accept, with your example, for instance, can you accept if God says, okay, you need to be wearing a head covering? And can you accept that and be like, all right, you're God, so you're right. You know, I'll wear the head covering. Because there are plenty of people who in that situation, and it sounds crazy, but I think there are plenty of people who are so steeped in the whatever dogma they're in that even in the presence of God will argue and will not accept whatever, you know, God is handing down. I think that there are people like that. Basically what that means is they can't face judgment. So if God says, okay, you didn't wear your head covering, this was wrong. Okay. How do you handle that? Right. So I think that in your case, you would say, yes, that was wrong.
Yeah.
You would accept the guilt and the responsibility and the blame. And then, you know, if you probably do it after that point, and, you know, you get what I'm saying.
Yeah.
And I think a very good example of this is the parable of the, there's a parable, and I don't remember what it's called or exactly where it is, but you've got two groups of people, and Jesus goes to one group. He says to them, when I was thirsty, you didn't give me something to drink, and when I need somewhere to stay, you didn't give me shelter. So on and so forth. Like you didn't do all these things for me, right? And this group says, when did I not do this for you, Jesus? Basically, they're saying like, I did the checklist. So like, when did I, like, what are you talking about? I did everything right. And then he says, when you didn't do it for these least of my children, you didn't for me. And generally people take this parable to mean like give to the poor or something like that. But I think the greater meaning out of it is to take the attitude. So you've got this group of people that are saying that think that just are so confident and so caught up in the dogma that it's like, hey, I did my checklist. I did everything right. You, Christ, the King, have no right to tell me that I didn't, basically. I did everything. But then you have the other attitude. You have the other group of people where he says, when I was thirsty, you gave me something to drink. And when I needed shelter, you gave me a place to stay and so on and so forth. And those people say, Jesus, when did I do this for you? And so and that attitude is like, I didn't do anything for you. I did nothing to deserve anything that, you know, like, it's the opposite attitude. And mm-hmm. when I think of this, and I think this is a good exercise. So put yourself in the position of the first group. So you're standing before Christ, and he says, you know, you didn't do these things for me, et cetera. Well, how do you react to that? Do you say, well, you're right. I really didn't, you know, and you're Christ, and you're the King, and you said that, and, you know, I accept your judgment, or I accept that. If that's your attitude, then you're probably good, right?
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, if you can really imagine yourself in that group and Christ telling you, you know, you didn't do what you had to do or you didn't do blah, 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 and if you, I don't know. So you got to kind of imagine yourself in that. And if you have the heart to and the humility to just submit and say, okay, well, you know, you're Christ, you're the King, so, you know, whatever you say goes. Then, like, that's what I think God is looking for, and so.
The humility.
Anyway.
Mm-hmm.
Right. And if you have that attitude, you're probably not going to be in the first group. You're probably going to be in the second group, you know, and you're probably
exactly
going to be
right.
A good one, so. So that's something, that's a good exercise to do, I think, but you have to be really honest with yourself because it's hard to do. And
exactly.
So that's another reason to be honest with yourself because you put yourself on the wrong track and then when reality hits, it's like you're really screwed. Really screwed. So.
And they won't even know why. I'm going to do a little segue and play a video by our friend Malin.
Sure.
This is the story of your enslavement. I'm sure you've heard it. But this is just the first half of it. We can play the second half if you'd like. Yeah. Awesome. So here we go. Three, two.
Yeah.
This is the story of your enslavement. How it came to be. And how you can finally be free. Like all animals, human beings want to dominate and exploit the resources around them. At first, we mostly hunted and fished and ate off the land, but then something magical and terrible happened to our minds. We became, alone among the animals, afraid of death. And of future loss. And this was the start of a great tragedy and an even greater possibility. You see, when we become afraid of death, of injury and imprisonment, we become controllable and so valuable in a way that no other resource could ever be. The greatest resource for any human being to control is not natural resources or tools or animals or land, but other human beings. You can frighten an animal because animals are afraid of pain in the moment, but you cannot frighten an animal with a loss of liberty, with torture or imprisonment in the future, because animals have very little sense of tomorrow. You cannot threaten a cow with torture or a sheep with death. You cannot swing a sword at a tree and scream at it to produce more fruit or hold a burning torch to a field and demand more wheat. You cannot get more eggs by threatening a hen, but you can get a man to give you his eggs by threatening him. This human farming has been the most profitable and destructive occupation throughout history, and it is now reaching its destructive climax. Human society cannot be rationally understood until it is seen for what it is. A series of farms where human farmers own human livestock. Some people get confused because governments provide healthcare and water and education and roads, and thus imagine that there is some benevolence at work. Nothing could be further from the reality. Farmers provide healthcare and irrigation and training to their livestock. Some people get confused because we are allowed certain liberties, and thus imagine that our governments protect our freedoms. But farmers plant their crops a certain distance apart to increase their yields and will allow certain animals larger stalls or fields if it means they will produce more meat and milk. In your country, your tax farm, your farmer grants you certain freedoms, not because he cares about your liberties, but because he wants to increase his profits. Are you beginning to see the nature of the cage you were born into? There have been four major phases of human farming. The first phase in ancient Egypt was direct and brutal human compulsion. Human bodies were controlled, but the creative productivity of the human mind remained beyond the reach of the whip and the brand and the shackles. Slaves remained woefully underproductive and required enormous resources to control. The second phase was the Roman model, wherein slaves were granted some capacity for freedom, ingenuity, and creativity, which raised their productivity. This increased the wealth of Rome, and thus the tax income of the Roman government, and with this additional wealth, Rome became an empire, destroying the economic freedoms that fed its power and collapsed. I'm sure that this does not seem entirely unfamiliar. After the collapse of Rome, the feudal model introduced the concept of livestock ownership and taxation. Instead of being directly owned, peasants farmed land that they could retain as long as they paid off the local warlords. This model eventually broke down due to the continual subdivision of productive land and was destroyed during the enclosure movement when land was consolidated and hundreds of thousands of peasants were kicked off their ancestral lands because new farming techniques made larger farms more productive with fewer people. The increased productivity of the later Middle Ages created the excess food required for the expansion of towns and cities, which in turn gave rise to the modern democratic model of human ownership. As displaced peasants flooded into the cities, a huge stock of cheap human capital became available to the rising industrialists. And the ruling class of human farmers quickly realized that they could make more money by letting their livestock choose their own occupations. Under the democratic model, direct slave ownership has been replaced by the mafia model. The mafia rarely owns businesses directly, but rather sends thugs around once a month to steal from the business owners. You are now allowed to choose your own occupation, which raises your productivity, and thus the taxes you can pay to your masters.
Okay, so that was the first half. Any thoughts?
Yeah, I really like the way he says mafia. It makes me kind of smile a little bit every time I hear him say it. Mafia.
Yeah.
He's got a few ticks like that. Well, my first thing that that occurred, and I might have learned this from Molyneux, I don't remember, but in the days of slavery in the Americas, right, the owners, people that owned the slaves, would invest about 80% of what the slaves produced in the slaves. So they actually got most of what they worked for, what came to them through, you know, their housing, some extent of medical care, because a slave was a big investment, right? So just letting their slaves die was not particularly profitable. So there was some extent of medical care. They were fed, obviously. I mean, you can't work very well if you're starving.
Right.
So anyway, but the relevant part of that is that we get taxed at least 20%, you know, depending, it depends on how much you're making. But if you're getting taxed more than 20%, you're actually, it's pretty similar to the slavery. I mean, obviously you can make a lot more choices and slaves good, but in a way it's kind of like slavery in a way. Because you're paying as much to the government as slaves did to their masters, essentially. I mean, it's obviously better. I'm not saying that it's the same thing by any means, but there's definitely some similarities there.
Right.
And yeah, and like you said, I've listened to it before. It's been years, but I've definitely listened to that before. And it's a tough one. Now, I think in the United States, we're somewhat unique, being an armed citizenry, in that we actually have some, even though nowadays it's kind of small, we have some element of the government not owning us, but us owning the government.
Well, that's how it's supposed to be, right?
Yeah, yeah. But when all the COVID lockdowns happened, for instance, it depends on where you're at, but like in Michigan, for instance, there was one restaurant, that stayed open, didn't close the whole time. And despite all of the orders to shut down and whatnot. And there was a lot of defiance. A lot of people didn't wear the masks. There was a gas station where the workers weren't wearing masks at one point. And this one guy came in with his mask on and was yelling at the worker about it. And I told him, like, look, like they don't have the policy here. This is their store. So, you know, you don't like it, go somewhere else.
He's right.
Like, well,
it was a recommendation.
This or
it was
that.
Not a law.
Yeah. Well, yeah, because they can't in the United States. You can't force somebody to wear a mask or wear an accessory or whatever. Yeah, he said that, and I said, well, go and call the police then. Screw them, you know, because I knew that they couldn't do anything even if he did. But yeah, and I argued about it because it really ticked me off that the guy was giving crap to the gas station worker, you know, about not wearing a mask. And I had to say something. But there was definitely quite a bit of defiance going on. And there was a big protest in Lansing, too. And people went there to protest the lockdown. They didn't wear masks. A lot of people were still driving around and doing things. So there's definitely, in the United States, at least, there's still a good, I don't know if good is the right term, but there's still a level of defiance of you don't own me towards the state.
Yeah,
so,
that's true. The scariest part about it for me was the airports, the airlines, because that's talking about, you know, interfering with our right to travel, right? And, you know, I was in this camp where, you know, I ran dental offices for a decade. And I know that walking from one room to another with the same mask on, it was an infection control violation prior to the cuckoo virus. right? And now all of a sudden you could lose your license in California, your medical license, if you say otherwise. If you remind people that it was an infection control violation, or that, you know, if you remind people that Fauci even said that wearing a mask doesn't do anything. And
right.
So I push back on it pretty hardcore. And, you know, I would go into, any store I wanted to. One time I actually was picking the kids up from the airport, and they were not allowing me to go because they were unaccompanied minors. So you go to the gate to get the children.
Yeah.
But they were not allowing me even to go to the gate in order to pick up the children. Yeah.
How did your kids get to you? Did one of the workers escort them or something?
No, my husband ended up going because he played the game better than I did. But especially things like, you know, I had to go to the doctor's office and they're trying to tell me that I had to wear a mask in order to, I had kidney stones in 2019 and I had to get an ultrasound, and they were trying, and I actually might have had to get another, the ultrasound was the determination on whether I was going to have another kidney surgery. And they were telling me that I couldn't get the ultrasound because I had a medical exemption. And I had a medical exemption. I carried it around with me everywhere. I played that part of the game. And I eventually won. I eventually got my ultrasound, and I did not wear a mask. Any store that I wanted to go into, I went into without a mask on. Besides REI.
Well,
REI would not let me in the door.
Well, I respect the right of the property owner to require a mask on their property. So for me, if I go into a store...
That's an ADA violation. There are people with disabilities who cannot wear masks. And you can, you know, would you respect the right of a business owner to say that we don't want African Americans to shop here, or is that illegal?
I would. It is illegal, but it's illegal, but I don't think that it should be. I'm more of a property rights absolutist, I guess. I think that would be a very poor business plan, and I think that person would probably not stay in business very long, or it would open up a whole different market for someone else for competition to come in.
What about
but I don't think it should be illegal.
What about wheelchair accessibility? You think that people should be able to make that business decision not to put in a wheelchair ramp because that's their property and they can do what they want with it?
Mm-hmm. Well, it's right. So really then the question is because I have to point out the gun in the situation. Is it right to point a gun at somebody and tell them who has a business and tell them you better put this wheelchair ramp in, or, you know, I'm going to forcefully shut down your business? I don't think that's right. So of the two things, I would say what's worse is to point a gun at somebody, which is what laws are. Laws are pointing guns at people. You can't separate that. Point a gun at somebody and tell them if they're going to open a business, they must do a wheelchair ramp or whatever. So I think that someone not putting – it's kind of a dick move, but I don't think it should be illegal, I guess.
Okay, what about public places? What about, people – what about places that our tax dollars go to support?
Yeah, so that's different. Now, generally what I think is that those places should not exist because taxes shouldn't exist, but they do exist. So, but the way that I would see that is that the property owner is the state or the government, whatever government association that owns it, which is beholden to the constituents. So I guess that would be up to the constituents, you know, to vote on what the standards are for the public areas.
Right. Well, haven't they already?
I don't know. Sure. Yeah, I suppose. I'm not sure because I'm not sure if you're talking about like federal or state. Like, there's a big difference in local governments and whatnot. so
well,
I'm
talking about public land, whether it be federal or state. Laws have been passed saying, like, so, like, for instance, a few months ago, I had to go to the Social Security office. My son lost his, or we lost his Social Security card. Didn't lose it. It's actually in Texas with his dad. Long story short, we needed to get another copy. And we were refused entry because both of us have mask exemptions. And we were refused access, you know, to this public building or the DMV for a long time, was turning people away from doing DMV services who would not or could not wear masks.
Yeah, that is pretty messed up. Well, because the part of the deal is with that is that so that's something that there's a restriction that the government has put in place as far as for the DMV. So, I mean, with licensing and with whatever it is. So basically, I think that because the government is placing these artificial restrictions on your activities, that they have an obligation and a duty to allow you to go there. Because the thing is that you, whatever thing you're trying to do, like, I don't know what you're doing there, but like whatever it is you're trying to do, you don't really need the government to do it. Like, if the DMV didn't exist, you would just do whatever it is you want to do instead of going to get, like, a license or a, I don't know, whatever it was you were there for, right?
Mm-hmm.
Does that make sense?
Sure, so, but that's not hypothetical. We're talking about laws that are already in place in this country.
You know?
I know,
and, I get that.
Yeah. So, I'm with you with the DMV. I don't think it should exist. I don't think Social Security should exist, and I don't think taxes should exist. But, you know, when you're in a, you know, it's been one of my main goals in life for the last few years to make it so that these establishments don't exist. But when we live in the world that we do and we still have to navigate it, for them to take away the right to travel, to travel freely, to go into these places that, you know, that we have to get along in this country, and telling us that we can't do that, because basically we won't put something that we know doesn't work and potentially could be hazardous to us, over our faces. And prior to the scamdemic, people were aware of these laws. Like, you can't, as a Starbucks employee, force somebody to wear a medical device on their mask, on their face. That was illegal, right? So they're infringing on my rights to be able to breathe fresh air, to be able to make the decisions for my body. And so that's really something that I fought against often. And it was very interesting that it was the big box stores, like the Targets, like the Walmarts, like the Home Depots, they have teams of lawyers that knew that these things were not mandates or not laws. And you can ask somebody to put on a mask, but you can't force them to wear a mask. And it was these small mom and pop stores that were the ones that were terrified of being shut down by the government. So really it's like, you're talking about your right, the business rights, of these private business owners.
Property rights.
But really, that's not it. They were so terrified of being shut down that they were infringing on my rights, right? So
yeah,
does that make sense?
That's true. Well, yeah, that's true. But that's a secondary effect of something the government was doing, not like a, what I'm saying? It's not a decision they would have made on their own, I don't think. It's a decision that they were compelled by fear.
Well, right. And so as far as the absolutist, the free, business rights absolutist, the infringement comes from the government, not the other way around, right? So they're being
forced.
Not from
the property owner.
Yeah, exactly. And like I said, when I went into
these. And that's where the crime is. The crime is the pressure being put on the property owner, not the policy of the – I think you get what I'm saying.
Yeah, I do. But again, it's very interesting that I never got harassed when I went into the Home Depots or the Walmarts. People may have come up to me and said something, or even like Starbucks.
I had that happen
or
once.
Yeah, even like the, you know, my local grocery store, I was harassed several times by employees, but I knew my rights. And, you know, at the end of the day, I got an apology from the manager and a gift card. Same thing with Starbucks, right? Like, you know, there was a story in San Diego of a Starbucks that that would not serve a woman for not wearing a mask. Her name's Amber, friend of the show. And she, you know, she got kicked out of the store. It got traction with some kind of news article. And this barista got like $20,000 in GoFundMe for kicking this woman out. And I feel like these kind of stories embolden these minimum wage employees. Sorry, I'm not trying to bash on minimum wage employees, but these are people who probably never had an ounce of power in their life. And now all of a sudden they're given, this tremendous authority over people. And you saw it come out. You saw these minimum wage employees, you know, stand up tall and, you know, kick people out with conviction, you know, really feeling like they're doing the right thing. Only later on to find out that the businesses weren't really there, you know, backing this kind of stuff to begin with. But these people hear these kind of stories about this, you know, getting money for quote unquote doing the right thing. And it really did add to the fuel to the fire.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, it was a mess. But I think that what's happened so far, it seems that the public, sort of general public perception, is that everything was overdone. I don't think there are a lot of people right now that look back on the mask policy, that look back on the lockdowns and think, yeah, that was the right thing to do. You know, I don't think that's very common.
Security office a couple months ago.
Huh?
Except for things like this Social Security office a couple months ago, the Social Security office there, and they were hiding behind a union contract that said that everybody who went in there had to have a mask on. And
oh,
it's
that's
like,
weird.
Yeah.
Yeah, there are,
you know,
holdouts for sure. But.
And California is definitely a holdout.
Yeah.
I'm surprised they haven't gone back to the mask, quote unquote, mandates again. They're toying around with it in LA, and they're reinstituting the mask mandates.
Yeah, but for is COVID come back there, or like what was the reasoning?
Yeah, COVID cases. What do they call it? The twindemic, where RSV virus. Oh, also the flu season, right? Now they're taking it and saying that masks can stop viruses, and there's never been studies that prove that they stop viruses, but now they can stop all the viruses.
Oh,
right? They can probably stop a bullet.
Oh, yeah. Well, that would actually be a real problem, though, because if people are I think this is a setup for a huge problem. You have people isolating and doing all these things to avoid ever getting sick. Because I really think your immune system is kind of like a muscle. And the more you get viruses and exercise it, the stronger it is.
Correct.
And if you rely too much on modern medicine and things like that, then I think your body just gets weak as far as. So, but that's actually good for me because viruses tend to adapt to, like, they don't want to have to be any stronger than, they want to be any stronger than they have to be, because that's kind of a, and I know it's not exactly a will, it's a evolutionary force, but it's a survival thing, but they end up being no stronger than they have to be. So if there's a bunch of people with really weak immune systems because they've been using modern medicine and everything else to not have to use their immune system, that means weaker viruses, which means I'll get sick less. So
I
guess in my selfish mind says, go for it. I'll be good.
That's true. That, you know, that there's some merit to that for sure. You know, especially because, yeah, in day-to-day life, we pass people on the streets and we get pieces of viruses, and then our body recognizes them, and we build up immune system, you know, our immune system to these viruses. But it really, you know, bothers me that that virtually everything that piece of instruction advice that our health community gave to us about this virus made it worse, right? Everybody, you know, instead of getting outside and seeing people and getting in sunlight and things like that, all of these things that help our immune system, we locked ourselves away. We over-sanitized things. We closed the gyms. We kept the liquor stores open. We closed the spas, the saunas. In that press conference, I watched virtually all of the press conferences for the coronavirus task force when it came out. And there was one conference where I think it was DHS took the virus into a lab and came out with recommendations on what kills it, and the biggest things that killed it were heat, humidity, and sunlight. And
yeah,
but of course,
but nope,
so
everybody stay inside.
Yes, but
can't
so I'm watching this. And, you know, we get to the portion of it where the press gets to ask questions, right? And the first question was from a reporter who said, well, is Trump really telling us that we should be injecting bleach? And remember, I watch all of these things. And I watched
bleach.
That press conference. Yeah. And I was like, what the heck? Wait, no, I watched the whole press conference. Trump never said anything like that, not even close. So I'm like, what is going on? They just told us after being locked down for all of this time, you know, inside, no sunlight, all of this stuff, and you're telling us finally that heat, humidity, and sunlight kills it, but nobody talked about that in the media. Nobody talked about that for weeks after that. It was Trump said to inject yourself with bleach. Trump said to inject yourself with bleach. No, he didn't. And why is it that the media, you know, deflected so much and wouldn't, you know, tell us?
They lied with the question.
That these things that they told us were fake.
Yeah, it's garbage.
Mm-hmm.
And it's like, in the biggest thing that bothers me nowadays is that it seems to me like the voter base in our country. It's kind of on autopilot. Like,
yeah.
There's no thought. And if you just check the D or the R, it doesn't even matter if the person is alive.
Yep.
Like, it's what do you do with that? Like, I don't know. You know, like, that's the sort of thing where I get a little bit blackpilled because I'm like, well, with the voter base being what it is, it's like, what? Like, how is it going to get better? Like
it won't be in the ballot box.
Right.
These policies
will
not help us.
Yeah.
Unfortunately.
Yeah, because the voter base is asleep at the wheel.
Exactly.
So it's sad. And
it's
sad for me. It's kind of because I fought for that, you know. I know that the Iraq War wasn't exactly defending the Constitution. It's like it was something different, but that's why I joined, because I believe in that, and I believe in the Bill of Rights and the representative republic. I guess I'm kind of an anarcho-capitalist now, but you know, but I believe in those principles: self-determination. You know, the Second Amendment and that's what the Second Amendment is about. It's about self-determination. It's not about like. It's kind of self-defense. I mean, that's in there, but it's about the fact that if I own a firearm, if I'm armed, then I'm not relying on someone else to defend my life, liberty, and property. Like, it's on me because I am armed. Me taking responsibility for my own life, liberty, and property.
Correct.
And if I'm not, and if my only defense is to call a cop, then I'm basically relegating all the responsibility for my life, liberty, and property to someone else, which I think is a shitty way to live. That's the child's way to go, to right. like calling daddy.
Right.
And that's something I really believe very strongly in. It's sad to see it kind of start to crumble, but
yeah,
like you said, I don't know what the solution is. So
we just have to
kind of try to live my life and adapt. I'm sorry.
I said we just have to turn our backs on the system. Eventually, you know, there'll be an overstep so big, and it's possible that it could be the fact that so many people are waking up to the fact to the reality that our votes don't matter. This mechanism that gives us our freedom is tarnished because people do think like for better or for worse, I didn't vote harder. I didn't vote hard enough. I didn't, I didn't go and ask friends to vote. But at the end of the day, there's so much voter fraud that this system that makes us free is corrupted beyond repair. And I hope that when enough people wake up to that fact, that we'll turn our backs on the system and withdraw consent from it.
What does that look like? Do you mean like not paying taxes?
For a start, you know, planting your own food,
I remember.
Being self-sufficient, taking back the control of the information flow, taking back control of our health, you know, not relying on these, you know, multi-billion-dollar corporations that we know in the past have caused tremendous harm. Our life expectancy is as low as it was in 1996 now. Like, we're going backwards because of the opioid crisis, you know, the same companies that feed us these vaccines, you know. And so, you know, hopefully enough people wake up to the fact that these things are not good for us and that we can't trust these systems and we do it ourselves. We stop relying on the system completely and figure out another way.
Yeah, man, it sucks, though, because I hate farming. I've got a little bit of land and I don't have enough to support myself. You know, you need 5 acres, which I don't have, but I've got a little bit of land and I could like plant something there, but I mean, I'm home a couple days a week and I'm on the road most of the time. And it's like, do I really want to spend all my spare time just tending to fields?
Well,
not
and that's
really.
True. And I'm not necessarily saying that everybody needs to plant their own food. But I'm saying to be a part of a system in which, you know, you as a truck driver, earn your wage through, you know, food instead of, you know, so that's what you can offer to the community is food distribution. Somebody else will be the one that's growing your food. I have a marketable skill. Yes. Right. And everybody's got a marketable skill.
And you don't want to be in a job that can only exist through forcing people to pay you.
So, yeah.
Because at some point that might end, and then you're kind of up shit creek. By that, I mean government jobs.
Right.
Like you want to get paid for something that is an actual skill that you can do, not get paid because someone with a gun is forcing people to pay you. So.
Right. Ultimately, I would think that the law would be obsolete as well. You know, one of those government type of jobs that shouldn't be necessary if we all cooperate.
Well, I think that there's always going to be some kind of conflict resolution. Maybe it'll look differently, but if you're going to have property rights, you've got to have some kind of conflict resolution when someone damages your property or yourself, or, you know, we can't really totally get rid of that, but it could certainly be privatized. It doesn't have to be a government doing it. So.
Right. Right. Cause when the government gets involved, that's when, you know, things really does. What does Malinu say? That the government that starts out the smallest will always end up the largest.
Yeah, it's inefficient because it doesn't respond to the market forces. So, it's like you end up paying for a lot of stuff that you don't want. Like, roads are a great example. It's like, oh, well, you know, how do we pay for the roads? But the thing is that, like, maybe that people don't want roads that badly. I mean, I think people want roads badly enough that they'll be there. But the thing is, if people want something badly enough, they'll cough up the cash and it'll happen. You don't have to force someone to pay for something they want.
Right.
That's kind of a silly notion.
But when you look at things like California, you know, we just keep paying and paying and paying and paying. Taxes get raised. We get charged, you know, I think it's like something like 21 cents a gallon. I might even be wrong on that. It could be even higher per gallon of gas that just goes to taxes. And most of it is supposed to go towards the roads, yet we still have potholes that you could plant a tree in, you know, like and the roads are no good, you know. So it's like, yeah, people will pay for it, but what exactly are we paying for? Because it certainly isn't roads.
Right. There's no accountability at all, really.
Exactly.
Not in any real sense. So that's very true. But now in a private sector, there's plenty of accountability because if someone else isn't doing a good job, then there's someone else. If someone isn't doing a good job, then someone else will and get done.
Sort of, except for what about industries like power, you know, energy, right? Like you look at the example of the two major gas companies in California, PG&E and SDG&E. They are rated worst in the country as far as customer satisfaction. But there's really nothing out there to compete, even in California, sunny California, where, you know, we can put solar panels on every roof. SDG&E still regulates those.
Yeah. Well, but STG doesn't have the power on its own to regulate those, right? STG doesn't have that power.
They do. You can't, I mean, unless you go in and buy, you know, whole home, you know, generators, like powery battery
banks. Oh, okay.
Like,
I see what you're saying.
Yeah, like at the farm, we've got solar panels, but they plug into our SDG&E. We pay little to nothing, right? But it's still regulated by SDG&E.
Yeah, no, I see what you're saying. But it's the government that grants that power to them. Like, why is there not another power company?
That's true. But what I'm saying is it's not as simple as just saying, let's just have some healthy competition here and have somebody put in some all new power lines and, you know, and compete with this infrastructure that's been subsidized by the government, right? Like you can't really go in and compete with that efficiently. There's no way to do it because of the monopoly that these power companies have on the system.
Right. I don't know. I don't know. That's something that I don't – and that's the thing about – how did Molyneux put it? He put it really well. It's something like if I could answer that the question of how to do something like that, right, then government would work. But I can't because I'm one person. I really don't know a lot about – I mean, I know quite a bit actually about electricity because I took some college courses, but – I mean, I don't know a lot about, you know, installing power lines and all that mess. So I can't really give you an answer.
Yeah.
But that's the thing about the market is that I don't have to have the answer. Is that but someone will have the best answer. It won't be me.
Right.
If you know what I'm saying. Like, I can't tell you how, like, a free market power structure or power infrastructure would work. I just know that it would be better because
it would be.
When you let people do things. Yeah. But I can't do the specifics because if I could add all the answers, then, you know, I could run for president and fix everything or something, but I can't.
Right. Yeah, that's definitely true. I think that it can work with a lot of industries, but the ones that we need that are in the most peril are the ones that, you know, not a lot of people have the resources, the finances or the know-how to fix.
Yeah. Well, I mean, we can take Twitter as an example. not a lot of people have the money to buy Twitter and you know, fix that, but someone did.
Yeah, well, we'll see. He might not be CEO for too much longer.
Well, yeah, but I mean, I think he's already kind of dropped the bomb. So.
Right, exactly. Yeah, he's blown it up, and now he's going to just walk away.
Well, and because he's not the CEO, it doesn't mean he doesn't own it. So I don't know if he's selling it or if he's just letting someone else run it. But mm-hmm. if he's the owner of the company, he still is in charge. He can tell the CEO how to run the company, you know, or he can, if the CEO is doing something that he doesn't like, he can say, no, you're not doing that if he maintains ownership of the company.
That's true.
So, for all of
those people in the past who said that, well, Twitter was a private company and they can do whatever they want. No, it's not a private company. But until Elon Musk took it over, then he took it off the stock exchange, right? Because you can't simultaneously say it's a private company and have it publicly traded. You know what I mean? So, So you know what? We've got a caller. So let's bring in the caller here.
Hey, it's Leslie.
Hi, Leslie. Merry Christmas.
Merry Christmas. Merry Christmas. You too. And I just kind of, I'm not entirely, the fire alarm just stopped at my apartment. So I wanted to call in. So I just want to share because I think, okay, so I work with a lot of Cuban refugees, and last night I was working with them, and I'm learning Spanish because I'm in Texas, and you really need to have a working vocabulary of Spanish here because you got to adapt to change sometimes.
Yeah.
Half the night, I was saying, Feliz cumpleaños.
Oh, geez.
I was saying happy birthday. instead of Feliz Navidad.
Well, it kind of works. Isn't this supposed to be Jesus' birthday? So, I mean.
Yeah, I'm like, oh, see, it is Feliz cumpleaños para Jesus.
Have you had a couple of Christmas drinks?
Not like I should have. Let me tell
you.
Yeah,
right. It's funny. So, you know, I live in San Diego, both of you do. And a long, long time ago, I worked at a restaurant. And so I knew enough Spanish, like just because I was raised around it, to know especially the dirty words. And all of the guys in the kitchen were Mexican, and they mainly spoke Spanish, and they would say these nasty things. And Mom of the Good News Report is fluent in street Spanish and in school Spanish, book Spanish. So I tell her, I said, you know, gosh, it's just like, I know what they're saying, but like, I don't know if they know. And she goes, I'll teach you something. And they will, and if you get this right and you tell them this phrase in Spanish, they will never do it again. They will never, you know, speak dirty to you again. So I learned it. And the next time I went into work, they say their nasty little things to me. And I turn to them and say, ¿Piensas que es posible para vivir en el sur de California por toda su vida y no aprender un poquito de español? Which is, do you think it's possible to live in Southern California for your entire life and not know a little bit of Spanish? And they went white in the face like they'd seen a ghost. And they never said anything nasty to me again.
You know, my husband's family is from the Philippines.
Mm-hmm.
And a good portion of their language is Tagalog.
Mm-hmm.
And they have talked about me because it's Tagalog, but a lot of it is Spanish too. Because like everything else, Spain conquered the Philippines. Spain has conquered like everyone, and their DNA can be found in almost everybody because, wow, They sure did conquer. They pillaged. They plundered. They woo. They conquered. So a lot of their language is Spanish. So one day I was sitting at the table, and you know, the family, of course, just talked about me, and I would just feel like, I would act like I didn't know anything. And then their next door neighbor came over, and she was from like Argentina. And I asked her where she was from. I loved her accent. She told me. And then I started speaking to her in Spanish. And I, while I can't speak with fluency, I can carry on a very basic conversation. His mother looked at me, and her eyes were as big as she is. And she said, "You know Spanish?" I said, "No hablo español bien porque entiendo más o menos aprendo." You know, which is like a very rude, very basic way of saying, "Listen, I don't speak Spanish very well, but I understand."
Yeah.
And she was just like, "I didn't know this." And I said, "I know."
Yep.
I was just like very matter of fact. I was like, "I know." I looked at her like with that judgment face, with my mouth kind of closed. And I said, "I know."
That's so funny. Yeah, because I don't really speak Spanish. I understand it a little bit. But I know that one pretty complicated phrase. And then, like, other than that, it's like, "Donde está mi llaves?" You know, like, that's basically it. Where's the bathroom? And things like that.
Yeah, you know what, though? I love these women. I'm learning how to cook Cuban foods. And I read a recipe that was inspired by the Cuban sandwich, right? Mm-hmm. And I brought a ham to them last night. And I realized that there's a lot of things in the Cuban culture that mimic the Filipino culture, which I'm well-versed in. Mm-hmm. So, you know, of course, I'm getting a divorce. And that's about as much fun as sticking an ice stick in my eye. I don't know.
Jumping headfirst onto a thumbtack is my favorite.
You know
what?
Yeah,
that too.
Yeah. You know what? One time I gave natural childbirth to a child that got stuck. Ooh. It was painful. And, you know, she's 12 now, but... You know, not talking to my kids today, you know.
Aww.
Yeah. So, and I know there's other people here, and it's really weird how I'm learning things firsthand. So, I get it, you know. When there's some things that have happened to me that me and the laws need to change in the state, and I will be working on that. But anyway, so I made a macaroni and cheese, and it's gluten-free because I only serve gluten-free, and I'm allergic to ham. So I had to be really careful with the ham because I'm allergic to it. Uh-oh. Oh, for the love of Jesus. Could people stop cooking today? Oh, okay, good. Give me a minute and it'll start going off again. Okay, so this is really good. And this is a different way to make macaroni and cheese. So you take some Velveeta, right? And then you throw, like, you do a lot of Swiss cheese, Bacardi. You use a lot of the white cheeses.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
Yep.
Okay. Red bell pepper, Jamaican jerk seasoning, and spicy brown mustard. This will change your life. I won't. Oh, and you do onion and garlic in that, but it's the spicy brown mustard, and I won't eat my macaroni and cheese any other way. And this, and I gave it to my girls last night. And their eyes got big, and they were like, oh, yes. See, I'm like, because I always ask them yes or no. And I also took some plain yogurt, because they love yogurt. And I taught them a new word, which is parfait.
Mm-hmm.
And I took this plain yogurt, added vanilla. Beer belly white chocolate powder.
Ooh.
And I dipped it with a fine, you know, with a fine whisk. And I served it. It's like an organic version of Cocoa Puffs. I served it layered organic version of Cocoa Puffs and topped it with chocolate chips.
Ooh.
Oh my goodness. It was so good. And because it was like low in sugar, I added sugar because why not? And then I made some with cacao. And because these women are Cuban, they understood when I showed them that I used cacao. They got so excited because it's a very expensive thing. So I put cacao in there, and I mean, like, I made these, and they looked like custom dessert. I mean, they were gorgeous. So, yeah, and also because no one in Cuba can eat Oreos. Because they're very heavily taxed. They're rich people food. I bring gluten-free Oreos with me.
Aww.
And sometimes they come in and they're like, por favor, un Oreo?
the real question then is, can you make deep-fried gluten-free Oreos?
Oh.
Well, I'm from Texas. I can deep-fry anything.
There you go.
Elizabeth, press one, my love. We want to hear from you.
Huh?
My normal co-host just called in. She might just be listening, but
okay.
Merry Christmas, my love. Here she is.
Yeah, I was like watching from the window on the street.
From the bleachers, yes.
How are you? Merry Christmas. I'm like, they're talking about food. I'm just making some cheese.
Let me tell you, it's that gluten-free macaroni cheese.
Merry Christmas.
It's insanely good.
Merry Christmas. Elizabeth, tell us about your day. How was your Christmas?
Oh, it's beautiful Christmas. I am sicker than shit, so I have been in bed coughing and old lady stuff. Every time I cough, I pee. That's how sick I am.
Oh, no.
I think it's normal because it's just age.
The propaganda of the flu's here. No, the fucking flu is here. I got it. And I was like, and everybody else has got it, too. And it's like, wow, this is nasty. So I decided not to bring any more, you know, all the old people that are still alive, they can stay alive for a little longer because I'm not going to be the one to make you sick. So
I think it was probably 100 degree temperature difference between here and there in Chicago today. I think we got a high of 78.
It was 30, I think it was 39 below zero the other night. I'd be getting up to start my call so it doesn't like go into deep freeze. And
I drove through there this morning.
Yeah, today I risked it because it was 3 degrees. No, it was 12 degrees today. And I was like, it's brand new. It's gonna have to make its way through the world and start tomorrow on its own, if need be. But this is what I did, and this is an old Christmas. I love it because what we do is we play music. All the old music. And we do the, I was going to say crossword puzzle. It's not a crossword puzzle. It's a jigsaw puzzle. And my cousin's up in Michigan. Her and her family are there, like, with no power. They do this every holiday. And they go, and then they make cookies, and they do jigsaw puzzles. Because that's what we would do with our families. There's always a jigsaw puzzle on the table. There was never any TV. And we had the 45s that fit on that little clip. There was a clip before there was 9mm clips. There was a clip that fit the 45s on the stereo. And we would be loaded up with all the little 45s, you know. And I found an old radio station on the AM radio. And I've been listening to it all day. It's all the old Christmas shows, the Christmas Carol and Jack Benny and all these intertwined with all the just the old stuff from the 40s and the 50s, which to me is Christmas.
Every time a bell rings, an angel gets his wings.
Yes, that's one. I haven't seen that. I missed it. I told my sister I don't have cable. She said, why? I said, I know. I'm too cheap, apparently. I'm doing penance, it feels like, because I'm missing out on all those great movies. I haven't gotten around to it, but I've been so just relaxed and doing the old, this. It's like going down memory lane with all these old things. And this is what Christmas used to be like. And my neighbors brought me food. They brought me all of their homemade Mexican stuff they do. Like last night they made the pozole, and they brought that up to me. And I got, you know, more soups, and I got gifts. And it's just, it's kickback nice. Talk to everybody on the phone. Everybody's kind of chilling. We got a small family emergency. I hope it goes well on one end. Someone has a torn retina, as it turns out. Not a stroke.
Oh, no.
This was like 2 days. It was like the night before Christmas. When it's like, oh, I thought, oh, my God, this is terrible. So Christmas was canceled on one end because we've got a medical emergency. And on the other end, I'm like, I don't want to get everybody sick. So we did our Christmas.
Yeah.
Leslie,
we sat around and ate pork and gluten all day. So we had carnitas, which is,
That sounds good. Do you know what I'm having delivered tomorrow, though? Because
what's that?
I have so many good friends. Prime rib roasts.
I like the ends.
I was invited. They're like, oh, we're going to bring it. I said, oh, I love you. Thank you. No, this is the round one. It's with all the ribs are in it. So it looks like like a bundt cake, but out of, you know, prime rib with big bones.
Ooh. I don't know if I know about that.
Oh, well, honey, that's like a fucking $100, $200. And that's got to be $200 right now to get one of those. It used to be about a good $80 to buy something like that.
Uh-huh.
And then you just cut. It's like those decadent Henry VIII pork chops, but it's made out of beef. Those
mm-hmm.
That's what that is. And that's the prime rib with the bone in. I don't think you get those much at the restaurant. You get the bone cut out, and then you get the prime rib.
Is that the prime rib, or is that the ribeye with the bone in?
Oh, you know what? You might be right on that one.
I'll eat that whole thing.
You know,
I'll be over tomorrow.
Yeah, no shit. I'm not good with details and words and names and things.
Well, you're sick. It's okay.
I'm prone to make the. I mean, when I'm not sick, I make shit up. It's whatever I call it. That's what we call it. That's what I grew up calling.
Well, I'm sorry that you're not feeling well.
Thank you, baby. But I'm actually feeling much better. I even got my appetite back, which is fantastic. But today would have been. This is what we do on Christmas. We have the open house at the family farm. You've seen pictures of the farm. And that farmhouse was my great-grandparents' house. And the door to the farmhouse has never had a lock on it. So you just open, and it's like stuck like it, as if the humidity expanded the wood. So it's one of those you can barely get in. So boom, so you get the noise of that door opening up, and you clop over some boots up into the kitchen, and everybody's there. You know, it's an open house for breakfast, lunch, and dinner. And I missed it this year because I'm like, I'm not going to bring the scurvy flu over there. But that's going on. And so you've got all day Skittles of bacon and sausage and eggs going. and orange juice and coffee. And just great conversation. And then this was the piece de la resistance, is the Monopoly game, because we played Monopoly back in the day when we were kids. And so we're all like 60-year-old cousins. We were going to play Monopoly today. It was going to be like really kick-ass. We made these plans last couple days ago. Yes, so that's what I missed. And I was just like, damn.
Okay, that reminds me. I was at the grocery store the other day, and I took a picture of it because I was so, like, insulted by it. Let me find it. Here we go. It was a Monopoly game. Monopoly, like, you know, Future Edition, San Diego Edition, Chicago Edition, whatever. This is Monopoly Crooked Cash Edition, where it comes with a decoder, like at the grocery store, how they get that little pen and write on the $100 bill to make sure that they're real. Yeah, it comes with a real decoder to try to find fake dollars in Monopoly. I was like, what the fuck?
It seems like a game you couldn't play more than once.
We would play it all day long, and we would cheat until the parents came in, and they were like, this is not how you play this. It's like, yes, this is how we play it. And if my dad ever played, it was like no fun at all, because we had to like follow all the rules. And it was like, this is not how we play it. No, we don't play it this way. We always had money, and somebody was always loan sharking and stealing somebody's hotels and, you know, switching out the shoe and the top hat.
I'll be your chores for a week if you give me $500.
Yeah, it was fantastic. It was so much fun. Loved it. And it was like marathons. And my cousin, when we were in our 20s, he finally got like the kick-ass wooden edition. They had like the gold pieces, and it was like on a piece of wood that rotated. Lazy Susan. It was like, whoa. He's like, no, I can't touch this. This is mine. I'm like, can we play that? No. I don't know that. I was hoping he was going to clean it out. That's what we played today. But I don't know that you could find those. My little guy told me he's got the Mario. I said, no, Mario Monopoly's not what we played. We played real Monopoly. So that breaks my heart that they've even changed it to robotize our children with scanners and barcodes and QR codes or whatever the fuck that shit is. Oh, my God.
Yeah. Monopoly. QR code edition. That'll be next.
That's why I was like, so, like, what is the best one that they've been playing? Oh, they even had, like, Lucy and My Favorite Husband. There's all these old shows, but they all did their Christmas shit. And it was just, like, took you back to the time when you had real Christmas trees. Like, nobody had fake Christmas trees. They were always a different kind of a fir tree, and then you had the long, tangly, glittery stuff. What was that stuff called? They sell it. Tinsel, yes. That was everywhere, a little bit of lights. And it was just different. Everything was different.
Yeah.
It was more simple.
I don't do Christmas trees. I feel like they're pagan, you know. They definitely are pagan.
They are. You know what? I was thinking about that in a lot. It's like, let people enjoy their holidays and their family traditions, whatever it may be. It's a fun time, whether it be
John and I were talking about this earlier, because we come from, John and I were talking about this earlier because we come from same, like, similar / same religious backgrounds. We created a church back in the day. I used to hate, I said this earlier on the show, but I used to hate Christmas because it was, to me, such a pagan bastardization, right? And I used to rage for years, for decades about it. And then one day I was like, I look around and I see everybody being happy except for me. And that's when I honestly decided my husband and I got married on Christmas Day. This is actually our anniversary. So that we would have something happy to celebrate Christmas.
It's so cool.
Yeah.
Well, and it's a shame that, you got to temper knowledge with a bit of moderation. Because when you become an extremist, nobody enjoys your company, you know? And it's like, you got to, like, know that, you know, yeah, this is not really good. And when you really, like, look at the black and white, unless you're actually killing somebody on Christmas and you're performing, you know, like, Moloch-like, you know, rituals.
Which sacrifices, which a lot of people do this day of the year.
I know.
You know, this is when JonBenet died.
I know, but it's kind of like, I go back to I had a nice childhood, you know, we didn't live that world, and, you know, and Christmas, Brenda Lee, and a 45, those Christmas songs, and all the grandparents, Everybody smelled the whiskey, you know, and they were all having fun, and playing cards, and it was fun, we were all running around, and it was just a fun time.
It's family, it's togetherness, it's community.
And it's a tradition. It's kind of like, then, you know, you have your birthdays and your holidays. But it keeps the family together and you're happy. And I went through a period where I was very extremist in my beliefs. And it was kind of like, I didn't celebrate any religion or holidays because it was, you know, a sin and blah, blah, blah. And my family, she's like, I remember when you were like that, when you cut us all out of your life. And I was like, ooh, yeah, okay, sorry. Because I wouldn't go to meals for me.
Exactly. And I'm glad I found a way around it, you know? I'm glad I found a way to be happy and merry and cheerful and loving and thankful and, you know, just full of life today instead of the rage that I used to be in on these holidays.
Yeah. I wonder if it doesn't come, you mellow with age. Because when you first think about things, it's like you're very idealistic and staunch in your militant kind of ways, sort of. You're standing in your truth. And the older you get, you see that it kind of doesn't make a bit of difference how people conduct their lives. It's more of how your time is both spent in the relationships you have. And people are going to do that.
Go ahead, John.
Yeah, I was in fact so militant in my youth that I was in the military. I just thought that was funny.
It was
incredibly militant.
You know, compared to anything now, that was what you were supposed to do. That was an admirable thing. You know, you were a good boy. You followed, you know, you did all the things right, you know, and you should have had, like, the most amazing life because you followed the course of what we're supposed to do.
Right.
I don't know if amazing is what I would say,
but now,
it's working out pretty good.
Cute play on words. You know, just
I even brought up this earlier in the show. All things work to the good who love God are called according to his purpose. So no matter how angry and militant that we were in the past, you know, now the fact that our hearts are softened, you know, I was scrolling through Facebook today and I saw several posts about people like, all right, sheeple, you know, everything's pagan and the tree's pagan and the...
I blocked somebody because I'm like, where did you come from and why do I know you? And we don't have that many common friends. And I went through and I'm like, you're just crazy. He's actually crazy. So I blocked him. I thought, you know what? Knowing what I know, I don't. Who knows what you do on your spare time? You're gone.
It's probably the same person. We're probably talking about the same person.
He had a crazy long name. Frankenstein was part of it, and I'm like, it was like Jesus Frankenstein something or other. I'm like, how did you get on my feet? And I'm like,
no, seriously.
You know, he's screaming about it. It was so funny because people were screaming Merry Christmas to him. He put out one of those demanding posts. If you obviously didn't read my post, because if you're saying Merry Christmas and I'm blocking 500 of you, blah, blah, and everybody's like, Merry Christmas. I think I even want him because here I am. I'm like, this is how I got to be. I'm like, just block this lunatic. Merry Christmas is what I put in that.
That's better than fuck you.
It's crazy. You know, so he blows in flames and he threatened everybody that said Merry Christmas to him. But Etha's like, this is exactly what this man needs to hear because he's crazy. You cannot take people's, you know, you're exactly like a tyrannical dictator that we're all in falling out of love with because they want us to think exactly how they say we should think and act. And if that's how you are with your opinions and your beliefs, you're no better than the person that you despise. You know,
right.
Well, most of us are. You know what I'm saying? So that's where you mean, like that. Yeah, yeah. So, yeah, and it's and I'm like, Mom, chill. And that's why I'm like, I need to, Pink, I'm so not feeling well. I'm like, I'm not fit for humanity today. So I went in my pajamas and back in time and I found a good station. And I'm like, I'll let the crazies be crazies. But I saw all that. And I feel bad for those people. You know, it's almost like, how come you can't have, here's, what's that one that's so good? I like with Natalie Wood, Miracle on 34th Street, where it's kind of like the little girl, when she's a little girl, more, you know, her. Is her mom that puts on the Macy's parade and Santa Claus, and she knows Santa Claus is fake. And it was just like it brought back the ability for little kids to believe in magic and what ifs. It was a great movie. And that to me is like the beauty of Christmas. It's not so much a religious thing, because to me, I think Easter is more like that. Easter is more of a religious kind of holiday for me, I think. Christmas is more about fun and magic.
And magic, right.
And seriously, and good magic, though. It's like the magic of Christmas, and the gift of the Magi. Oh, my God, is that a great story. I don't think – are they projecting any of these types of movies, or is it all like people are talking about these – oh, God, Die Hard? Like action movies. Are there Christmas movies?
I heard the Christmas movie, actually, yeah.
Oh, it's not.
I like
Christmas Vacation, the National Lampoon's Christmas Vacation. That's my go-to.
Okay.
Yes.
I can see that.
Yeah.
I could see that, you know. They were cute, tongue in cheek. Not my cup of tea, but I did like, Bill Murray and John Candy, Trains and Automobiles.
Yeah, and Scrooge. We rewatched Scrooge this year.
That's a pretty good one. Excuse me, this is where I'm sick. Holy fuck. Sorry, excuse me. I'm almost better, though. But it saddens me that Die Hard is a Christmas movie, because I'm like, oh, God, no, what's the message in that? Only because they played it on Christmas, that makes it a Christmas movie. And that's where I'm
sad for
myself.
I think it takes place on Christmas. That's why it's a Christmas movie.
What?
I think it takes place on Christmas. That's why it's a Christmas movie.
I'm sorry. That doesn't make it a Christmas movie. It has some Christmas message.
I think that's the justification. How's that?
Well, you know what? The Hollywood writers, they all went through their drug-induced haze, and what we got out of their drugs, the movies.
Yeah.
The cocaine movies of the 80s, and I don't know, the 90s was crazy. But the movies that they've been putting out, it's so sad, and it all is based upon no creativity, and they're like all on drugs and not good drugs either.
So we just hit our 90 seconds.
They've been getting better.
I would like to give everybody the opportunity to say their final wishes for the year. This is our last show for the year. So Elizabeth, you want to go quick, and then we'll let Leslie and then John go.
Well, I wish everyone to just have a fantastic holiday, and, you know, it's never as bad as it seems. It's always darkest before the dawn, and we've got a lot to be happy. And I'm thankful for having friends like you, and Leslie, I hope you come back so I can get to you. And John, Merry Christmas, God bless, love you, and love you, Daniel.
Love you so much, Elizabeth. Leslie?
Thank you, baby.
I just wanted to say that, I do predictions, and they're on point. Next year is going to be a better year for everyone. The things that the people that have been pushing back against a lot of stuff are making waves, and I just wanted to say, I think they're going to be better. This year.
Absolutely.
It's kind of going to be
We're at five seconds, so I love you all. Please share this if you can. And we'll see you next year. Goodbye.
Merry Christmas, guys.
Merry Christmas.
All right.
Bye, guys.